You recall that I talked a great deal about pattern integrity. And there was one episode in my life that I think really dramatizes the pattern integrity. In 1930, I was asked to speak at Dartmouth University. And I had my Dimax in-house at that time in Marlow. And they had me speak in the Dartmouth Hall, which was a very old hall there. And all went well. Pretty many years went by, and I was asked in 1947, 17 years later, to come back to Dartmouth to speak. And I spoke again at Dartmouth Hall. But in the meantime, there had been a great fire, and Dartmouth Hall had been burnt up, and they were so fond of it, they built an exact replica. So I was introduced to the audience as having been there 17 years ago, and when I began to speak, I said I didn't like to be contradictory, but I'd never been there before. I said Dartmouth Hall had burnt down, so we obviously weren't in the same building. And in the meantime, 17 years, all my cells had changed. There was nothing of the only thing that really had any identity were my eyeglasses, which hadn't changed. So here we have an artifact of one of the extracorporeal extensions of human beings that I spoke to you about, which was really more permanently part of the pattern of me than any of my flesh or bones. So that the audience really understood quite well what I was talking about in the pattern of integrity. I'm going to talk now about my strategy, my feeling as we go along now about how I carry on. I've certainly, obviously, done my best to present to you a grand strategy of problem solving. I brought you into some mathematical thinking about that. And I've done my best to introduce large patterns, because we know why I've done that, but if we see enough pattern, we may have a chance to discover some of the repetitive, the periodic relationships that are occurring, and we can really witness fundamental change in the evolutionary relationship of human beings to the universe. But I have in my storage here several other large pattern considerations that I employ a great deal. I must get those out of the way, and then I'm going to gradually come in much more tightly on the energetic geometry. We just touch a few items there, and I'm going to come in on what I call design science. I'll come in on our world game, and I'll come down to great deal of where we are on our planet right now, what I see going on with all humanity, and particularly what I feel the little human individual can do. But each little human being is so aware of so many other human beings, and the planet being so big, and the complexity of things that are already operative when you check in the picture and the automobiles are rushing by, whatever it may be, doesn't seem very good prospect to the individual that he's going to be able to be very effective in this great big pattern. He might expect to be fairly effective in a local pattern with a few people, but what the human little individual human can do about humans on board of our planet in a big way seems for the moment pretty formidable challenge. So I will talk more about that with you, because I'm confident the little individual can do a great deal, and every one of the human individuals are going to be able to do a great deal. And if you catch on to the strategies that I employ, you may be able to employ them too. You may want to. I've talked to tonight. I'm going to clean up two or three items. One thing I've talked a great deal to you about is precession. And we mentioned it a number of times, and you now know what it is I refer to when I say precession. And I'm now going to talk much more about it, because I find that this seemed to me very clearly in evidence long, long ago that the gap between the humanities and the sciences I hope this all stays in the picture. The gap between the humanities and the sciences that C.P. Snow talks about in The Two Worlds, I feel is one that is spannable, and since C.P. Snow wrote his book, we have met and have talked with him video about it, and he tells me he has changed his mind now. He does think it can be spanned. And I felt when I was young that there were so many things that I could see and feel very clearly, but I kept looking then for scientific concepts, principles, which I did not feel that I or other human beings tended to sense very clearly. And of all the big ones, I came to precession is by far the seemed to me the least sense. You have the words, and I'm going to just go through some things as a child. The fundamental spontaneous participation of a child in the permitted degrees of freedom of our universe, and what I'm saying makes me think that I may start a little further away from the immediate demonstration precession, and because I think these are so interconnected, these child experiences, that I'd rather start a little earlier in the child experience thinking. And as in the previous nights, I have told you I'm going to do a little digression, but we'll not forget where we are at all. I thought a whole lot about what the relationship of the grown-up to the child, and relation to what everybody discussed a great deal, education. And I mentioned to you the other night, trying to identify as closely as I could what it was that I personally was conscious of doing when I say I'm thinking. Recognizing there was a great deal of spontaneity of preoccupation, and subconscious things do occur, that we find that our brain does seek for information when we ask it a question. And thinking about the relationship of the older people to children, and the idea that the child is not an empty container which the grown-ups then gradually insert their knowledge and their wisdom, that the child has incredibly high potential, the faculties that are there, the way they could really be used if they're not frustrated by circumstances, and circumstances could be animate or inanimate. And going to our friend Pattern Integrity. Going to our friend Pattern Integrity. I want you to think about a little child being born, as we said time and again, absolutely helpless for months, can't even move itself around, naked, beautiful equipment but no experience, therefore ignorant. So this had a little child, and the little child has been, his mother so used to the idea of this little child is helpless that she moves around and she lays in the crib and so forth, and the child is lying on the bed, and as a much time going on, the child is growing, and its feet are growing longer, legs are getting longer, and its feet are weighing more, its hands are weighing more, and so forth. And there comes a day when the child is lying on the bed, mother's left him there, and he's moving his terminals, which he's been doing a long time, and suddenly the child gets his leg up like this and an arm at the same time. He didn't realize it, and it overweights him, and he rolls over. And nobody around. Mom hasn't moved me. This is great. I didn't know I could do that. So the child, what was it I did? Made it keep doing it, and over it goes again. Very often children roll the edge of the bed and go off. And luckily they're designed hydraulically and pneumatically, as we've talked about, and so they can take really quite a fall and a punch like that. It distributes the load so beautifully, the hydraulics. It doesn't do any harm. But there's a great memory of something that happened as a consequence of moving around experimentally on your own. You get a little trouble here. Something hurt. So that we have a little child then crawling around on the floor, and then gradually climbing up and things. Because there's something around here that mother isn't around here. There's something every time I try to do this, he's doing this to me. And I, there's a lot going on around here without mom. The thing that's around here all the time keeps moving everything this way. So finally, the child does learn to stand up. So, but it's very, very conscious of this thing. So the child's feeling that in me, running around the house, and this suddenly see the banisters. I want to realize also in this little child doing this, also wants to get back up, he like wants to get climb up and things right away. He got a feeling of sort of working against his thing goes that way. So he learns about getting up on the up on the things like that. And then coming off of it, he learned that he, wish I had him all in me. Learned to get on the bed, and he can remember about it. He wants to get off the bed. They laid him on the bed. So he wants to get off, and he learns he can angle himself up like this. Something to do about angles. When he got angles like this, he, I don't have to go further. So he can do that. He angles up like that, and they push his back a leg here. So he angles himself like this, and his legs out over the edge of the bed. And he remembers that it hurt very much when you let go. So he learns to angle like this, and every time he gets a little too far, he learns to do this. And so changing his position, finally, let's go and goes here. Now, what he's been doing, this mysterious phenomenon that's around him. He doesn't have words phenomenon, he doesn't have word mysterious. He just feels this thing very powerfully. There's something here that when he does this way, he accelerates, and when he does this, it goes the brakes on. So he's got both an accelerator and a brake. It feels pretty bad, pretty dangerous. I want to get my legs as near as I can before I let go. So you keep putting on the brakes and finally get to go. And so I learned then this angle there's an angle control. There's something about vertical, there's something about horizontal. It doesn't have words, any such words. And a little child running around there sees the banisters in the house, and that angle looks kind of familiar to him. So that's sort of a critical angle, halfway between the accelerator and the brakes. And by the time he's been holding on to a lot of things, cramping, so I feel I can hold on to those banisters, and that angle there, I'll start sliding. So nobody can find it up, and sure enough, he let go of those, hold on again for some of the brakes, and he found a beautiful ride. So now there's something around him all the time that's not mom and nothing that gets him from here to there. So this child feels very strongly that coasting business, the angle of the acceleration he has. Suddenly there was a winter day, he'd never seen winter before, and now comes out of the front porch and it's all snowy and ice in the city. And he sees that angle on the steps there. He starts to go out, so walking out, and he never had ice or snow before, and didn't realize it was going to be slippery. He's used to the floors that are not slippery. And he goes sliding down the first steps to the street. I said, boy, that's great. So I don't want to hurt my back. So he quickly finds something he can sit on and starts doing it. The children are fantastically inventive about and finding something they can coast on. Now, this little child, the parents always afraid that children are going to get themselves in trouble. And I just point out to you, this child is perfectly spontaneously full of the awareness when he let go, the further he is from the floor, the more he sits. So there's something about height. There's also, if it's angular, if the angle feels right, he doesn't have any words yet, doesn't use the word angle, but he feels the angle, absolutely, completely. You know, just is hunching himself up like that, it can be more angular. Nothing more, as his hands have been doing all that time, his arms have been doing, he's angling. The angles are very, very familiar to him. And he has angular controls, so what he's doing is grasping like that. It's angular control. So he feels very strongly the angle, and he understands that horizontal, because the street is horizontal. I say he doesn't use the word horizontal, but the street is horizontal, which means brakes. It's going to stop. Therefore you feel, as long as you can see at the bottom where it comes level, you're perfectly well there just to go down the slide. Because you really felt there was some little friction, quite different from a free drop. As long as the right angle of feeling. So kids really judge this coasting thing very powerfully without anybody telling what to do. So I now have this child that's learned, and I say, no child will go over a cliff. Then I say, I'm telling this child will go off the cliff or go off the house. They couldn't be more aware of the hurt there. They automatically do not get in trouble. They only do these things when they can see the horizontal, they see the brakes. Couldn't be more logical. I had this little child who had never been out of the city, and this little child comes into the PAL and they go to television, and they're having the ski trials for Olympic ski trials in Hokkaido, Japan, and this little child is in Philadelphia, and they've been out of them. And he sees there's quite a mountain there. Well, he's had a pile of pillows on his bed, he can understand the hill, the feeling of the hill fine, that's a big one. And he can see then that angle, and he feels that feels good to him, and he sees the snow, and that seems good to him. So everything that goes on there in the skiing looks absolutely logical to him. And what the skier is doing, he's angling his using angles on his ankles, and it's entirely angling, which comes out. Everything's angled. Conditions angle. The child feels it absolutely, completely logical to him. Now what I'm getting at, incidentally, I was asked to come and speak in Aspen, Colorado in the winter. And 1972. And the professional who started Aspen as a ski run, after the army used it for training, the professional first they first had there to really turn it into a ski resort was Island. And Island was still there in 72. I don't know whether it still is. And Island said to me, have you ever skied? And I said, no, I never did. I did radio skating, but I never did skiing. I guess I'm much too old. He said, not necessarily. I said, if you'd like to, you have to get the right equipment to get you properly. If you like, I'll take you out and see how you do really get on. So we went at it for 2 or 3 days, and he said I could ski. And then I felt very, very, very obligated to this man. He was the professional. He was doing this all for nothing for me, and taking a tremendous amount of time. We were having hot tea and coffee after skiing, and I told him what I just told you, and I said that I'm not going to give you the scientific description of skiing. I'm going to give you the scientific generalization of skiing. It's called angular valving of gravity. He said, I never thought of it. That's exactly right. Isn't that interesting, really? There is a pattern in integrity. We're getting really out of generalization. We find that, and that this great skier really felt that was absolutely accurate, and he enjoyed it tremendously. This then relates to what I feel about education. That is, I'm absolutely confident that the child and the human being must teach itself. It must really find out. It has to have confidence as it goes. You got to get a feeling of what it is all about. Then, what the teacher can do is then. If the child has experienced a little of that, then the teacher can do what the television did. They can tell you that there's a great big mountain instead of this little hill out in front of the house, and the same principle is going to work. So the teacher must really only amplify what it is that the child already feels very, very deeply. And they assume that the child didn't feel it because they didn't have the word gravity or horizontal. It's absolute nonsense. those are very limited special ethnic experiences, and the communication is already, the lines are open, and whatever words have to be used are fine, and the child will take on the words as long as it's identifying what it feels. Now, this brings me back then, as I said, to precession, thinking about precession. I have a little child, and the little child then we found learned it could roll over. That is a whole lot, which is something not the original experience at all. So then little child, when he does finally stand up, having actually rotated, then little child very quickly finds children trying this. They have a lot of fun spinning around, spinning around. So then that is one of the prime motions of our universe. We have axial rotation of our planet. We have the axial is a very, very fundamental to the universe. Then we have the same little child learning that not only that, but he can also go into orbit, go around in a circle. Then he finds that he can go into orbit while axially rotating too. So we call that dancing. So we've got two very important motions of the universe here. Then the little child learns that it can taking his breath, expand and contract. Very fundamental motion of the universe. We've got three very important ones here. Now another one he can do is to twist his top one way and his bottom the other way. We call that twist in dancing now, but it's torque. So torque, we have axial, orbital, expansion, contraction, torque, four of them. Now, another one is a very fundamental. You just start kissing. Try to turn yourself inside out. I gave you the rubber glove the other day. Evoluting. A rubber donut, remember? Evoluting at the top and involuting at the bottom. So the child starts finding that involuting, evoluting. It's a pattern getting all of electromagnetics and so forth. Well, there are five most fundamental motions in the universe which the child is spontaneously familiar with, and you can talk about. But the word precession, you come to that, and the child's kind of blank, and the first child experience of precession that he might be able to catch on to is when his uncle brings him a top. And the uncle brings the top and then has quite a time winding it up, and then after a while, gets the top going. So the top is actually rotating very rapidly, but also, so it has a secondary, very slow motion. It's leaning way over like this. And then the child has learned when he leans way over like that, he keeps on going. So he said, "Uncle, why doesn't it fall over? It's just leaning." So uncle said, "I got to get a cigar," and that's the end of that. The reason, of course, is precession. And the reason he was familiar with these other five is that he seemed to do them all alone. One of the things that engineering tried to remind the non-engineer about is that every action has a reaction. But to a little child, the fact that he is doing this doesn't make him realize he's pushing the earth that way, though. He's so tiny, the earth is so big, just has, there's no such awareness. But of course, he is affecting that planet, and an incredibly meager degree, but he's doing so. Now, precession, I said, was the effect of bodies in motion on other bodies in motion. So he really was doing a precessional thing to the earth, but he's unaware of doing it. So the first five are familiar because they seem to be within yourself. And you do not think of the earth as in motion, even, let alone that you could push it along. I can understand that why precession has been so, in a sense, remote from the basic thinking of the individual feeling himself very independent on what seemed to be a flat earth going to infinity. And he's the only thing in motion. Now, precession, I was the science and technology advisor on the staff of Fortune magazine for 2 years. They had no editorial titles on Fortune, so that they did not put that on the articles when I wrote. But my job was to, when Fortune was taking one big corporation after another and explaining the great enormous work that corporation was doing and explaining which executives had the highest initiative and so forth. They did very good stories on these corporations. But the managing editor brought me on to Fortune and Henry Luce at that time in 1938 wanted me to try to bring home to the readers of Fortune a little more insight into the science technology that really lay behind that great corporation's activity. And I was only put on stories where the technology was something difficult. And when I came to do those stories, the chief scientist, the vice president in charge of research and engineering, whatever it might be, would always say to me, "It's going to be impossible for you to tell the Fortune readers what it is we are concerned with in depth in science here in our company, because it can only be expressed mathematically. And the Fortune readers don't read the mathematics, and very few of them do. Therefore, there's no way you can talk to them." And I'd been given a double spread for each of my stories to tell. And every instance, I was able to tell the Fortune reader what it was that engaged in depth without recourse to just the mathematical formulas. I was able to bring it into some sensibility that I just gave you, same kind of sensing, identification of experience of your own body. so we came to doing the Sperry Gyroscope Company in 1940. World War II was looming. Sperry not only had the gyroscope, but it was in an ordnance bomb site, and it was a very critical from a national defense policy. It was a critical area, and yet they did not feel it would be in any way putting that operation into jeopardy to have me talk something about the technology. And right, the very essence of the Sperry Gyroscope Company was a gyroscope. And the gyroscope does what it does as pure precession, which it employed. They said, just to show you how impossible your task is with double spread, we have to have a primer for the Naval Academy midshipmen, because the Navy uses so many gyroscopes, so many controls, that the naval officer has to have some important insights and what he's dealing with. Therefore, we have this primer, and it takes 50 pages to tell the Naval Academy midshipmen about precession in an important way, and it's entirely quantum mechanics. So that they said, your task is impossible. Now, I did, and I had only 30 days to work on this story, and I did come out with the explanation of the precession and the gyroscope, which I brought it to your own senses and did clarify, and the scientists of the Sperry Company said they really were astonished, but they agreed that it was not just a sort of happy analogy I was using, it was absolutely the direct explanation. And they had not realized it could be expressed in terms of senses. Because it seemed to be a very perverse matter. Precession seemed to be a very perverse thing, like a kid saying, why doesn't the top fall over? There are several matters that are going on in the precession where we're dealing in accelerations, and there are two kinds of accelerations that are recognized by the physicists. They're what they call linear and angular. Linear are obviously like that, or angular, just think about then swinging the weight around your head, the hammer thrower. It is angular acceleration while you're having some restraint on it and you're making it work in a circle, and you let go of it, and then it goes linear. Radial versus circumferential. The precessional one I spoke to you about is that, and we're going to try to have some sense of understanding why it is, because I'm sure that most people then feel that gravity is 180 degrees, the Earth, for instance, ought to fall into the sun. And why does the effect of the sun on the Earth make it go in orbit around it at 90 degrees instead of falling in? This is one reason why it seems perverse, because the child really thinks about that gravity pulling this way. It's very 180 degree fair, and it's just human beings can be very linear this way. They won't explain things very linearly. They're looking in this direction. So now I'm going to go into some explanation. I'm going to think about a athlete we call a hammer thrower, and we have the heavy weight ball, metal ball, and a rod, and two triangular handles for this professional hammer throwing. And he is lying on the ground. He gets into acceleration, and as he gets into acceleration, he gets out horizontal. And then here we get into something quite important, because he can actually build energy or momentum into the system as he gets accelerating this weight. And he gets going faster and really using his muscles to get enormous acceleration. Otherwise, you can accumulate energy in this angular acceleration. And so when he does let go of it, then it goes off in a line. With that angular acceleration, how far he throws it, how much energy really got built into the system. I'm going to have special apparatus for our... We're going to have a great Olympic hammer thrower. And we have a wide belt made from a very powerful belt. And has many hooks on it, powerful hooks. And we get him... take start one of these accelerations. He gets his ball accelerating, and we get him to hook it onto his belt, and we give him another one. He gets that going too, along with it. That's probably be in the opposite direction, because just balancing the weights very spontaneously. He gets that hooked onto his belt too. Now he's built up quite a motion. He can't really stop very much, so we can him another one. We keep giving him one of these, and get one by one, we get him accelerated, and hooks him onto his belt. He finally has really a whole grass skirt horizontally out here of all these balls, and there's so much momentum built into it that he cannot really stop himself. And he would be in a lot of trouble. So we've anticipated by the floor that he was on, we had already made a turntable, very nice turntable, ball-bearing turntable. But we'd had it locked so he could get it, shove off and get his acceleration. But now we release the table so it would spin right for him. And we also then make him really comfortable. We bring down a ball-bearing pad on his head from his arm from above. And so he's between the floor and moving around very easily. So the ball seems to build all that momentum. So it just gets, he's spinning around it. The balls, being so many, they're touching one another. But now then, I'm going to leave him spinning for a minute. That we're going to another man who's not really an Olympic game. He has a mouthful of plastic peas, and he's got a tube, aluminum tube, cut, and he's a pea shooter, and he's blowing peas out of the end of the tube, and We could use other things. Machine gun would hurt you if you put your finger in the way. We could use a hose of water, but you can't see the individual molecules. But pea shooter is very convenient because you can see the individual peas coming out. And if it blows good and hard, they go out fairly fast. So you find that with the peas coming out, you can come over and put your finger in the trajectory of the peas. And if you put your finger and come in the side like that, you make a deflect over there, can't you? Or you put a little bit under it and make it pop up a little. You can change it angularly. This is our friend angular valving. So we can change the trajectory. Now, the fact is that no matter how hard he blows, it only goes away before gravity pulls it to the earth. So the gravity... blowing. If you don't put your finger there, deflecting, there's no wind. As it blows it, the pea goes operates in a plane, and the plane is perpendicular to the earth, and gravity pulls it in it. So you could really describe this as a curve on a plane. So what happens when you put your finger there to move it on one side of the trajectory of the peas? You simply make a change like that, and gravity still things. So what you really do is push up the plane in which the pea is operating, you push it this way. Right? You feel that? Then if I remove my finger, the pea doesn't act as if there's an elastic band and try to go back to where it had been at all. It's simply, it's been changed its angle, and gravity is also changing. You've got two forces operating on the pea. Three forces, the original acceleration, then my deflection, and gravitational deflection. There are two angular deflections operating on it. But the point is that it does not then have memory and try to go back to what it was doing before. You understand that completely? The piece and the... And if I push my finger, the next pea will then go over here. So it has an... Each pea has, however, then a plane which it moves in. If we put a... a permanent finger here into the trajectory and left it there, all the peas would follow the same plane. You didn't push it any further. The plane could be reoriented, but the point is, the minute you stop pushing it, it holds that plane. It does not try to come back to where it was before. Now, I'm going to run, now we've learned individual P's can be deflected. And we can push one a little further than the other, but the individual can be, and once you're given this new angle, it's going to keep right on, and it's only, now only being affected by the gravity. Gravity is the other one that's altering it, the only one. Now I'm going to come back to this. Now that we've learned what happens in individual pellet, I recognize then this hammer thrower going around here. These are individual pellets that he has out there. They're individual energy units, and they're very much heavier than the P, but they follow the same laws exactly. If we had a cannonball coming out and had some kind of a steel finger you could put away, you could make the same deflection. Now, I'm going to point out that the ball bearing turntable we had underneath the hammer thrower and the ball bearing pad on his head, each one of them were mounted on arms, a vertical arm going that way and a vertical arm going that way, and they were mounted from an annular ring, a great big annular ring. An annular ring would go 90 degrees around on it from this pivotal point, and we got another set of hinges, of trunnions. We built what we call, and then that's mounted another ring. Get what you call gimbals. If you've seen gimbals for a gyroscope in it has now all X, Y, Z axi of rotatability. So this man is spinning and he's in gimbals. Now, I'm going to have him spinning out here in front of me, so you can see. I'm going to do it. I'll have him spinning over here, and I'm going to come over as those individual pellets go by, hammers. If I put my finger down in there, maybe I put something guard on it so it won't hurt too much. If I put my finger down and touch one of those balls, I'm going to deflect it. Agree? So I keep my finger there, and the next one, so once I've deflected it, it doesn't have any memory, want to come back, so as the balls are going around, this one I touch it, and it goes down like that. But it had another restraint, which was the rod pulling it, which was just as the P had gravity pulling it, its own acceleration had been, gravity was no longer affecting it. You can do that. But the point is that the rod was really tantamount to the gravity that pulled on the P. After I touch it, the rod is still holding onto it. So this pellet went by me here, I touch it, it goes down like that. But it's on a rod, so it's going to go around in a circle. So I keep my finger there and touch each of these pellets as they go by, and each of them peels off. I've had a nice mathematical control for my finger, so I just give it exactly the same touching. And each one of them peels off like that, one after the other, very much like airplanes coming along in a flight and they suddenly peel off. So all of them, one after the other, they get into then a new plane. The wheel which had been revolving horizontally here, you can see the man's in front of me here, and I've just touched it at this point. So each one of those pellets goes slanting down like that. From where I touched it, it slants like that, but then it stays in and goes around and comes up on the other side. So as each one, for the moment, it's really terrific bending of this thing because it's been a very severe angle to touch it. But it goes up. In fact, I keep my finger, they've all gone by and the whole thing's changed. It means then that the plane that I had been dealing in, I wish I had a little larger disk. Could you let me have your book? So I touched the pellet here, and one by one, and they slant like that. Because I did that. Can you see that? My deflection was this way as it went by. So this does this. But it was restrained, so you state the whole disk then does this. Which means then that the axle of that wheel also then has to stay perpendicular, because I mean, we had him this very wide belt, and he just normally has to. So the whole gimbal permitted that there were hinges on the end of the ring here, the horizontal end of the ring. So the whole thing is able to hinge that way. So when I touch it here, the whole disc changes like that. But the axle just goes over. You see that? Feels absolutely normal to what I told you, doesn't it? Nothing wrong with it. That's exactly what the wheels do. So now, I had a hammer saw, but I, instead of, I want to do them off. When you do touch a wheel, gyrating wheel, a rotating wheel like that, there's enormous strain in it, because you're really touching it in individual parts, and they're trying to really break the wheel in two. However, if before I had touched one of those pellets, I had, as if they went around, I had draped very powerful Scotch tape on top of it, glass Scotch tape, and it went all the way around. We'd have a condition where these balls are touching each other, and there's a tension tape on top of them. Therefore, if I touch this ball here, the blue one, on top, it's going to do this. It's against here, and then it's tensioned across so that it's simply going to pull like this. And this acts as a fulcrum, and it lifts on the one behind it. The third ball behind, as this one goes down, is going to lift the one behind it. As tension in the system, on top of the system, if I touch this here, it'll work back all through the whole wheel. So it helps the whole wheel to tip a little faster, because not only is the one I'm touching going down, but the one behind gets lifted. But all around the same axis, say, going around here, the axis between you and me, because I'm touching it here, and it's going in that plane. Now, then I point out that instead of putting the tape on the balls, I'm going to give the hammer thrower twice as many more balls and have him spin and get him loaded up. Now, we find that the first set, the acceleration is such that they were out horizontally in respect to his waist. And I've given him twice as many, so he gets a layer on top and a layer on bottom. And they are trying to go horizontal, so they press together on the ones that are already there. They'll nest in the valleys of them and grip them very tightly. If I gave them more layers, they all try to get into the horizontal plane, so they grip it even tighter. So it begins to act as a unit material and has the same tension effects as that tape I gave you. So this is then, I was more or less describing really what a flywheel looks like that you have in your gyroscope. But we understand the very center of that wheel as in its individual atoms, and really must be thought of as individual quanta doing just what I said. I've shown you how the quanta do the friction and the intertensioning of this. The friction of the one ball on top of the other would make it do it. We have the mass and attraction of the balls too. So you now understand that instead of thinking about the man as a man, I want you to think about it as a steel axle perpendicular to the wheel. So I'll simply tell you, if a gyroscopic wheel is moving in gimbals in front of me high speed, if I touch it, you probably heard of the thing. If you take any tiny little metal finger, just touch it here, the whole wheel does just what I said. It's going around this way. I touch it right here, and it rotates this way. Let me show you understand in front of me here. So there's an axis between you and I, and it rotates on that axis. Now, instead of touching a wheel, if it were made out of steel, it was a steel axle, supposing then semi, pushing down on the wheel here. I leaned in over the thing and took hold of the top of the axle, or took hold of the top of the gimbals of where the gyroscope was mounted, and I pulled the top towards me. It would be the same as if I pushed down here, wouldn't it? It's rotating this in this plane. I'm forced in this plane between you and I there in the circle there. So if I took hold of the top, pulled it towards me, then I would get exactly the same results if I pushed down here. So you do try that with a gyroscope. So you pull on here, and it doesn't yield to you. It goes over to your right. Now suddenly I want you to realize I've brought you clearly through so you understand. People say that's very perverse. I push on the top of the gyroscope thing here. Instead of it yielding to me, my pushing, it goes at right or left. It goes in the plane at 90 degrees. This is why my precession has been considered so difficult to understand, because human beings think it ought to go. If I push on it, it ought to yield the way I'm pushing it. And the fact is then if I push on it, it goes to the right. If I push on it harder, it goes faster. And it keeps going to the right as fast, so if I keep pushing on it, the whole thing keeps going around in a circle this way. The whole thing, the axle will be going around a circle at a not the direction I'm pulling, but in a plane perpendicular to me. If the wheel had originally been going the other way, it'll go that way. So long as I push it, it keeps on. If I push it harder, it goes faster. The minute I stop, everything stops. It doesn't have a memory trying to be something else at all. You can understand that, right? Now, this is the gyroscope. And I hope I've really introduced you why you felt the way through. Now, I didn't bring in the paradox of the way you feel until the end, so that you really could feel it with me all the way. Everything went on. It was absolutely normal. It's exactly what you experienced tells you will happen. So I find that the error has been in humanity really thinking 180 degrees. And you say, anybody can throw a straight ball. Now what really goes on when you throw the straight ball? The pitcher may get a part of a circle and wind up like this. He just sent them out. And it goes over like this. Now the fact is, the pitcher, you're looking that way, and you've been throwing balls for an awful long time. You say, I'm throwing that way, therefore I throw it there. You don't. He lets go here. At 90 degrees from the direction it wants to go, and that goes that direction. You may go on with his finger to put spin on it, which he does. And he doesn't try to stop himself right away, but the point is that his acceleration is this the way he let go and go to his 90. I want you to make that a little clearer. You're playing tennis, you're serving. You throw the ball up here and you hit it at 90 degrees, it goes over there. We've always been operating at 90, and we've been absolutely kidding ourselves and thinking that we're throwing the ball out here. We don't throw it out here at all. We throw it out here, it goes in the ground. Now, this is good fun to catch ourselves in ways in which we've been able really to deceive ourselves into what it is we're really doing. The precession couldn't be more normal. What's abnormal is that we've kidded ourselves and thinking it's 180 degrees. Trouble was the shooting of a gun, that fooled you. That's another kind of acceleration. But you tensed your bow, the bow was vertically, and you tensed it this way and it went that way. And just come back to when I remember with the rope, I took a piece of rope. I pulled on the rope. The more I pulled on it, the tauter it became, which meant that while I'm pulling it this way, it's going into compression at 90 degrees of my pulling. Remember that? The other day when I loaded in compression, all these rods already in close packing, they couldn't go towards each other. So as I blowed them, they all began to cigar. And the binding I had around went into was offset by this pressure, so my compressioning got a 90 degrees attention, and the tension got 90 degrees, compression 90 degrees, and I gave you the electromagnet and approached the copper coil. No electric current at all, but just electromagnet pushing it, and it induces a current, and the current goes at 90 degrees. And he sets up a field that says 90 degrees, don't come any further to this magnet. I start moving the magnet, everything stops. Precession stops. I start pulling the magnet the other way, and the copper wire becomes another current again, and sets up a field, tries to pull on, says, don't go away. The precession is completely regenerative. One brings out the other. So I gave you the other, dropping a stone in the water, and the wave went out that way. And this way beget that way, and that way beget that way, and that's why you circuit wave in it. Once you begin to get into precession, you find yourself understanding phenomena that you've seen those stones falling water for all your life, never really knowing just why the wave does what it does. Well, I'm now quite confident that I've taken you into precession and given you a very, actually hooked up your own senses with it. There was another phenomenon in there that's very important, which is acceleration as also orbital, the precessional effect of the moon, of the earth on the sun, the sun on the earth, making us go into orbit around the sun. And then we are doing the same to that moon. And I find then it is an amazing matter that Professor Goddard was not understood, and it's an amazing matter how really beautiful was Goddard's accrediting what Isaac Newton had discovered, which I also went over with you the other day. Every time you halve the distance between the two masses, you increase their interattractiveness fourfold. If you double the distance away, you decrease the interattractiveness to one quarter what it had been. Nobody really paid attention to these kind of things in a personal way, in terms of their senses. Professor Goddard did. So he said, our Earth is already going around the sun at 60,000 miles an hour. And if we gave some object an acceleration, because any object on board this planet is going also 60,000 miles an hour, this happens to be going around the sun at 60,000 miles an hour, just in company with the Earth. So if we give any object an additional acceleration over that 60,000 to make it then begin to leave the planet, then every time it gets to... Every time it doubles its distance out, it's going to reduce the tendency to fall in back in to one quarter what it was. You would not have to go very far out before you not tend to fall in anymore. It's just saying its own independent acceleration, its own orbiting. So, it's a garden, and it's a very simple matter. I find human beings again on board of our planet not tending to, we're so tiny and the total experience is so big, not tending to really get things into scale. But when we accelerate, and we were first told that the rocketed vehicles have gone into orbit, we thought of them as very far out, because our highest mountain, 5 miles, when we get to our airplanes, many of them are flying at the jets at 40,000, 30,000, 40,000, and well above Mount Everest kind of thing. We get to 50,000 and you're, what are you? That's only 10 miles out. So we get, and at 50,000 you can't see the plane. So when that's only 10 miles out, and you can't see it. So make 10 times out of 100 miles. Just assume that's fantastically far out in the blue, that way it looks to you and I on our planet. But the fact is that our vehicles began to go into orbit at 100 miles out. Now, the diameter of our Earth, 8,000 miles, and 100 miles in relation to 8,000 is a very small amount, isn't it? If I then take a thin paper match and glue it onto this globe here, that is 100 miles out from the surface of this globe. In other words, it would seem, look to you, exactly still in the globe still. But and now it's independent, it's in orbit. In other words, you don't have to go very far out in this universe before you get beyond what we call this critical proximity. You no longer tend to fall in. Falling in is a very, very rare part of our universe. Very seldom does anything get close enough to fall into anything else. The norm is orbit. And this 180-degree falling is something called critical proximity, when it really becomes part of this mass. Now, I want you to get yourself feeling a new norm here, of the normality of precession. It's also, then, I talked to you the other day about man and all the other creatures on board of our planet, and we went into how and why we're here. And I identified man as having a function in the universe, and that he, in order to get him ready for it, he had to go through being born naked and absolute ignorant, having to make trial and error to get somewhere, to learn generalized principles, where he could really then employ the principles to, as no other creature could, to make it possible for him to heal in larger and larger parts of the universe, and they could get the environments he'd never been in before, and get on appropriately to get more and more information, which is his function to process and to solve problems. So we have then all the biological life here to support and make possible that activity. We have the found that the mammals couldn't take any of the sun radiation through the skin to keep the energizing, re-energizing, which we all have, so that we remember then, I gave you the pattern of the root, trees being rooted in order to be able to do what they're doing, how they're getting the water and not to blow away. And then we found that because the vegetation was rooted, it couldn't procreate with other vegetation. All the insects and many, many moving mobile creatures designed to traffic back and forth between all the vegetations to cross-pollinize them so the whole system regenerate. So we have then the big thing is what we call the ecology, and really is an orbital affair. It is a cyclic affair, this way. But in order to get creatures to do these things, they give them chromosomic construction. They're designed structurally, mechanically, beautifully, and given the chromosomic drive to go after the honey. I had then man going after his honey, called money honey, something he could exchange for goods, because he then inadvertently having had his hunger, but also having procreated, which is inadvertently made children, got side effects, and it gets increases responsibility, so keeps going after this money honey more to try and take care of the side effects. And inadvertently begins then to do the things it's supposed to do. So I gave you then man with enormous fixation on the 180 degrees, but the precession and the orbiting is the normal. And that's what ecology is. This eternally regenerative universe and all the ecology on our planet, and to support the human within human minds' activity to really deal in principles of the universe and to solve local problems in pure principle is a very important function. So I hope I've now brought you back to really feeling the normality of the ecology and the normality of all the orbiting, and whether it's the orbiting of the electron around the nucleus, orbit. This is the normal of the universe. All the inner effects of all most bodies in motion and all other bodies in motion in the universe is all precessional. So I hope that instead of this being a word that seems remote to you now, it suddenly begins to be important. But it was also involved then in the picture I gave you of the hammer throw accelerating, that it wasn't horizontal. That is simply, again, if you accelerate an object on our planet enough, it tends to be independent. That's why a bicycle lying down on the ground is falling over, it yields to gravity. But you get on it, and the minute you start going along, the faster you go, the more vertical and stiffer you are. Because if you've got enough acceleration, you're going to leave Earth. So that's all you need. In other words, you tend to be leaving the earth. So the acceleration been given to those balls by the hammer thrower was such that they gravity no longer was a problem. They were really tending to be free in the universe. So I hope I've made clear all the items that need to be cleared to make precession seem to you normal. And remember yesterday when I gave you this, suddenly the octahedron, and just precessed the effect on that the octahedron, one pull effect. We precessed that one vector, and it turned like that, and went from fourness to threeness. And went from being generalized case to specialized case. And really probably every time we go into all the specials, we're going to nature reserves with one increment and so forth. So this is how we have the invisible, where all the special cases are all finite and discontinuous. We see how they can be. Now, I'm going to go into another area. And we haven't been going on long enough for a break now. So that I talked to you about my maps the other night, and I will not as yet go into how these maps are designed. We'll do that as we get into the synergetic geometries and so forth. But I do want to come back to man on our planet. I had given you the exercise of thinking about little man on an 8,000-mile globe, and that we are only the highest mountains. Remember, we're not the deepest oceans. That aberration could not be seen on a solid globe like this. So the actual fact is the ink with which we print the water on this globe is deeper than the water by a good deal. And so little you and I would be very invisible on such a phenomenon. Yet little you and I, in physical stature, having this mental capability that we looked into, to be able to take the inventory of all the chemical elements present in the 11.5 billion light years sweep out of the heavens, being able to develop the equipment to get into the invisible world, and being able to photograph the stars and so forth, 99.9% of which are not visible to our naked eye. That human beings are able to, that you tiny little you and I are really able to deal with these magnificent scale affairs and to get the kind of information we're having. Now, coming then to the development of human beings on board of our planet, which I went into a little with you the other day, I would like to go through going from that concept of the being born naked and have to be a place where you would not be eaten up and would not freeze to death, and the coral atolls of the South Pacific being the most favorable possible place where you could be born and where there'd be no big animals to eat you up and so forth. I personally have been, this is highly speculative what I'm going to talk to you now about, but I was in the regular United States Navy at the time of World War I, and I became tremendously interested in the possibility of what I call a sea archaeology versus a dry land archaeology. So all the archaeologists were digging in uncovering old cities and so forth, and putting together pieces. But it struck me very, very powerfully, because I was a sailor, was that the relative ignorance in the building of the land, we just piled stone on stone, in contradistinction to the what you really had to know about to be able to really build a successful boat, going from just a raft or a canoe, an outrigger, to big, deep-ribbed, big ships carrying incredible cargoes around our planet. And realizing, I'll just give you the, we went through the other day tensile strengths of mortar, you remember, and stone being 50,000 pounds of compression, only 50 in tensile, and that we got into the metals that had high tensile capability. Historically, in building, now and then, could gravity just help him? Could roll the stone over and get it to nest on top of other stones some kind of way, chip it so he could lay there. Gravity held the whole thing together. And the stone was approximately, relatively imperishable, so it seemed to last a long time. And the great walls that were built by human beings that way would crumble down when earthquakes came, but otherwise they were pretty secure, so an enemy might storm it and finally be able to knock down the wall. But the wall, this is the way things were built on the land. And the bigger and heavier and higher, the more secure people felt. So we see all those castles, this kind of building. You could finally learn to have a stone cobble out, come a little way, you can kettle out, so you get some fairly interesting designs after you're deeply familiar with them. But you still have to play with gravity. It's a sort of a game. Sure, don't tip too far out this way. Get a stone in here. So human beings then, dealing in almost completely compression and very poor tension capability. However, I want you to think about what a beam is. My hand is going to be a beam. My two arms are walls. I got a beam between the two walls. I can have a load on top here. As the load comes on top, the bottom tries to open up. As it tries to go like that way, the top goes into compression and the bottom goes into tension. And if the tension is not great, it just comes apart. So the whole thing comes down very quickly. Did you see that right? That's opening up. So when the Greeks then wanted to do some spanning, they had to get the columns very close to each other. And then they could get a very deep block of stone because you have a principle of leverage. The top is the fulcrum. And the deeper the stone is, the longer your lever arm, so that you know the further, longer lever your arm, the less effort, so that the stone is deep enough. The tension can hold it together. As it gets shoulder and shoulder, the tension necessary to offset this has to be greater and greater. Can you feel that, right? This is a lever here. So the deeper it is, the less effort to hold it together. So the Greeks used a very, very deep stone, and they only could span a very short distance between those two arms. Go and look at the Parthenon, and you'll see those stones that are up there are cracking too on the bottom. You see where they're trying to come apart. So we see you've got a very ancient, like Mycenae, and you've got a very small gate and a very deep stone. When they wanted to have any greater spans, they had to go to wood. So we find in all the antiquities, all these verticals, because the verticals are where gravity is holding it together. Then you go horizontal, gravity is trying to break it apart. So beautiful gravity holding together vertically, this way she works against it. Our old friend angular valving of gravity here. So we have the human beings then using wood, because wood, the masonry has said only 50 pounds a square inch, and then wood you could get up to 10, and if you get really very fancy woods, you get up to birch, very special swatches of birch, you might get up to 25,000, but wood, the tensile strengths of wood would be 5, 7, 10, 10,000 is very strong wood in tensile strength, but 10,000 as it gets 50 is very high. So, but wood was perishable, rotted and burnt and so forth. So that in antiquity we have all the verticals where gravity is holding together the stone, and the horizontals are gone because they if they're any span at all, because they were wood, rotted out. However, I want you to, as I said, if an earthquake came along, the whole thing went down. There is really no important business here, really, as a very powerful general, and he had enough slaves and captives, so we'll simply keep piling on the stone. There may be some artistic character around, so you'd like to have him chip the stone a little fancy for you. Or you'd like to have the general wants his name written in the stone there, or some picture of him. So there are people that had to do some superficial decorating, but engineering-wise, it was just a matter of pure muscle. Not really, not mind at all. But this business of tension begins to introduce something to you, and the principle of leverage we talk about is a generalized principle and has very important discrete usability. So we come to a ship of the sea. People found then, I spoke yesterday about the three-quarters of the earth being covered with water, 10% dry, 25% dry land, but only about half of that that was not rocks and deserts and ice, and getting down to around 1% that is immediately propitious to support human life, where the things were growing. There were grapes to be eaten, there were bananas, whatever it is, and people could get going. And the people continually find themselves, when nature went against it, there was a drought and things that didn't grow that year, so they were suddenly in mortal peril. And we went into the development of the city-state, or these walls, stone walls, and what the people who did find a very favorable place did was, like Mycenae and the beautiful Argolian plains there, they had found a hill in the middle of the valley, quite high, had a well, and they built a great stone wall up there, and then they built stone grain bins, and when they saw the enemy coming through the passes, they took all the food and put it inside, and they scorched the field, so the people came outside, and they were very hungry already. You only go 30 days without food, approximately, so just watch the people outside wilt away. We have then other people who found the water had fish, and you could live on that. But the water might look very beautiful down at the harbor there one day, and suddenly go out there in the sea, and an enormous storm comes from it. So the people found they really couldn't go off on the three-quarters of the earth, which is water, in any important degree, until they began to have better and better boats, because once you think about a boat, and it's got a big wave, and the boat is then a beam between these two waves. You see that, right? So the boat is then being a beam. My arms are the peaks of two waves, and my boat is between the two, so it's trying to do this. A minute later, the wave is in the middle of the boat, and then wants to go that way. So it's being racked this way and that way. Fantastic stresses, incredible stresses. Now, the difference between going to sea and being on the land is just incredible. Number one, I gave you, remember, crystallines, liquids, and gases. And the crystallines are triple bonded, three times, a lot of tension to hold them together there. But the liquids were hinged, so they distributed loads, and the gases were universally jointed, so they distributed loads, but were compressible, and the liquids are non-compressible. When we then get the amount of energy necessary to disturb the crystalline in the universe, it takes three times as much to disturb the crystalline as it does to disturb the gaseous, and only twice as much takes twice as much to disturb the liquid as it does to move the gases. In the universe, one of the most interesting part of the great patterns of energy is I gave you yesterday the degrees of freedom, the way energies can get within any given move you have. When you turn to play, you get six positive, six negative moves you can make. And you can get way out. And I showed you how we got distance differentials entering into the total experience. And so we have energies dispersed and expanding universe. We've been into our centropy and entropy and so forth. I'd like then to come to the thinking of fundamental experience, which is a relation to wave and frequency, the big ones. Fundamental to energy in quantum mechanics, you start with the universe has a given amount of energy, and you can invest that energy into a lot of little things or a few big things. You're going to be able to get it back again and reinvest it, but generally the universe has the big things, then could not happen as often. So the novae are really very infrequent. Novae are very infrequent. Earthquakes are not so very frequent. Mosquitoes are very high frequency. the smaller, the more frequent. That's the way of energy behaviors. So that the earthquakes occur on the land, rarely do you have enough energy motion on the earth to break the triple bond. But very frequently we have enough energies to disturb the water, only double bond. And even more frequently we have enough energy to disturb the air. So we find then the waves in the crystalline, the earthquake wave is just really a little tremor, a very small wave. But our waves in the water can get up as much as 10-story buildings at night. And the waves in the air get up to mile high. So it takes relatively little energy to make enormous disturbances in the atmosphere, and relatively small to make disturbances in liquid, but very rarely to have enough to have earthquake. Sea quake every day, almost. An earthquake all the time. The interface between the liquid and the gaseous system is one with very high frequency untoward enormous stresses are operative. And so you just cannot go out with a ship in the sea unless you really develop a capability, an engineering capability, dealing in principles in every kind of way, really understanding your tension, compression in an extraordinary way, understanding hydraulics and pneumatics, very fundamental ways. Okay, on the land, as you do, you have a job, and so you work for 8 hours and then call it a day. You can close all the shutters on the cottage and say that's the end of it. See, you can't shut down. It's a 24-hour job. See, just somebody continually comes to magnitudes of forced interaction with you and your ship, you've just got to be on the job. So, and then live 24 hours, and you know, let's say if he had a long day and maybe had a 12-hour day in the land, he at least had twice as much experience to see, because he got 24 hours out of everything of experience instead of 12. So the experience piled up very, very rapidly, and the severity of the untoward events, very high frequency. Therefore, those people who did come back are very aware of so many how didn't come back. And they went into anticipation. This is our friend, a comprehensive anticipatory design science. What are all the things you're going to have to anticipate? Furthermore, your ship, you had to carry, you're going to get in real distance, carry lots of food, and it brings you into all kinds of problems supplying that crew. So we find the ship wrapping, going very rapidly, differentiating into pure tension, pure compression, getting into what does make flexible cables. We've been in a lot of that. I've been into necklaces and structures with you, so you understand what I'm saying here. But the ship really very quickly accelerated man's familiarity with differentiated tension, compressioning, angular controls, leverage advantages, whatever it may be. And you find the earliest known picture of a ship is one on the quays of one of the priests in Egypt. And that first ship, if you are an engineer, you recognize she's a good-sized ship. Her complexity technologically was several masts. The tensionings and the compressionings and the triangulations that are in it are just phenomenal. At that time, the tools that were pictured on the walls of that Egyptian priest were very, very advanced tools for making the ship. In contradistinction to anything being used on land at that time, a wooden plow. The tools of the land were just childish and compared to the tools of that sea. That ship, quite clearly, if anybody gets into such matters, the evolution rate of which technology does improve, would realize that that ship had been in development for 50,000 years. She's a fantastic, mature affair. I'm not saying that ship was built, but the information went in there that was actually coped with and employed in principle to make that ship a success was of thousands of years accumulation. Now, number one, on the land, they get the sea crate, which if a flood comes along, you're completely licked. On the sea, it's a flood all the time. So you're designed for a flood, you better stand out of it. And your castle won't stand out of it. So you can't have that stone kind of thing out there in the sea. Gradually, I became, as more I studied these matters, the more I became aware that the science and engineering of building of ships in the sea and then later out of the sky were thousands of years ahead of the art of just building on the land, anything that weight and strong, so it didn't tip over, gravity holding together. So even as I grew up, we have the insurance companies saying, you know, strong as a rock of Gibraltar, and the idea was just inertia. And we don't get over that idea of the inertia, and society is yet not over it till the last great walls with those of the Maginot Line, and suddenly, boom, World War II is all over. Why? What happened was that World War I, the submarine coming along, the tank and the submarine were coming out of the sea, their technology of the sea. And they simply climbed up on up this time. You couldn't carry any great cargoes on the land at all. The railroad began to carry the great cargoes, but it had to have the great canals, you had to float things. The ocean, you can have incredibly large ships. Once you load your cargo, you can get it thousands of miles. And ships could carry loads that human beings couldn't carry in their backs, and couldn't carry in the backs of animals. As Sir Halford Mackinder showed in the English long ago, that when the railroad came along, they started the marine railway. The first railway was a marine railway. Built a ship to lay down in the sea using gravity to accelerate it in. And you had then with the marine railway, the ship could tip over. But they then doubled the idea so that your ship won't tip over, and this became the railroad. And they ran the tracks back on the land. They developed the steam engine for the ship, and so they put it on the donkey engine on the thing and run it back on the land. So Halford Mackinder showed the English the railroads were the ship technology coming up on the land, this advanced engineering really coming up on the land. And it warned the English that the coastline was not where they thought it was because of the ability to carry great cargoes suddenly up on the land. But the World War II tanks and so forth, what was called the Blitzkrieg, was the water technology coming up on the land, because on the land you have siege. And it's a trench wall. You just stay in, siege. But what happened long ago with the human beings developing city-states and the success of city-states being such as Mycenae, sometimes it became so successful that they had a chance to also get into producing boats. And probably the fall of Troy is the beginning of the city-state masters building ships. And the Greeks had these ships, and they then were able then to come up to the castle. Up to this time, the people outside the walls could be starved. But suddenly, the invaders came along with ships, and the ships could keep going off. The people inside of Troy just had so much food, they thought it was going to be great, that the people outside just going to starve. But the people who came along were not starving. They had ships bringing incredible cargoes. So suddenly, the line of supply began to be the new grand strategy of who's going to survive on our planet. We find then the time of, you look in Italy, all those great castellos commanding these different valleys, and they're great overlords giving themselves their name they want to. And suddenly, the man who's been developing ships, he's able to carry enormous cannon and so forth, he comes into harbor in Italy, there's a great castello there, and just lets him have a couple of shots, and he says, I don't want you to know any more about my grand strategy, because at sea, three-quarters of the earth being covered with water, the people who then built ships and built them to carry great cargoes from great distances with enormous, extraordinary risk to do it, did not tell the other man where they were going, when they would be back, or what they're going to have on board. Because the ocean is so big that the curvature of the earth that to say, the man's down under the horizon, 14 miles away from the sailing ship. And so that the sea kept her secrets. The people then went to sea and are going to produce enormous wealth by synergetics of getting resources that exist over here that don't exist at home. There's other resources that exist at home that seem to have no usefulness. But you bring these two together, and suddenly they produce something of enormous advantage, and great wealth has been generated. So that just when I was young, even the expression still was very, very prevalent, because I actually grew up with it, well, just the tail end of the clipper ship times. And they say, if you just wait till my ship comes in, one ship in, and it's a fortune. So it was an enormous big risk to build that thing, but if you could endure that thing, it would work. But you didn't want, no time at all, when you go to sea, to find the people who were able to build the very best ships had to be very powerful overlords on the land, because they had to be able to say, I'm going to build a ship. They had to be able to say, I want all you people who produce, all you woodworkers come down and build my ship. I want all you metalworkers come and work in my ship. I want all you people who've been sewing, making clothing, to make sails for my ship. They had to command the whole economy, and they had to say, all you people now grow food for my people working on my ship. That'd be a very powerful overlord. And to consolidate, they had to have a very good advisor, a very good designer, who's been well appraised of the experience of others before us. So he builds this great risky ship. Then there's another overlord who's not anywhere near as powerful, and he's very jealous of him. So he said, I know, very easy, I can just build a smaller ship. And I got to wait outside the harbor until the night before he gets home, we just take him over. And piracy became very, very popular. And simply a question on the water, incidentally, no time historically, because the people on the land anywhere enforce their laws out on the water, and then you can throw something. And projectile, so 3 mile limit, so forth. The law, three quarters of the earth is outside the law, and the people who then lived in that water ocean world really became world people, were inherently outlaws. And you find the top ones are called sovereigns, and the other ones are just pirates. So the great power became sovereign and gained a great respect. In fact, they told everybody in the world just how you carry on. And they set the standards. But finally, what came about changed a lot of this, and this mathematics. I did not talk to you about the Arabic numerals, did I? The Arabic numerals and the Roman numerals, you're familiar with the Roman numerals. Would you ever try to do any multiplication of the Roman numerals? Or division. How do you get on? You don't get on. The Roman numerals invented, again, I've talked about power structure. The power structure, man could have anybody, be very ignorant slave, say, I want you to stand here, and every time a sheep goes by, make a scratch. It was a scoring system. And had to do with things that kept life going. And this was the wealth. Every time a bag of wheat goes by, you make a scratch. And there was a supervisor, and he come along and make a secondary kind of his kind of check mark. It's like a V check mark today. So we have the scoring, and people, the whole Mediterranean world, the Roman Empire, using the scoring system. Not until 700 A.D., they come into what you and I were taught historically of civilization around that Mediterranean world. 700 A.D., the Arabic numerals begin to come in, but they're employed by people as a shorthand for the Roman numerals. So it's easier to go like that than to make three marks. And they were just thought of that way. The Arabic numerals, however, are quite... they had the cipher in it. And in a scoring system, you can't eat no sheep, so you didn't need a symbol for no sheep. You just wouldn't know exactly how many no sheep there were, how many symbols you needed it. So the cipher had absolutely no meaning to the people who used Roman numerals. It was a scoring system. So I thought that the cipher of the Arabic numerals was some sort of a decoration for a period that you put at the end of your work, whatever it is. And so the Arabic numerals then came into the Roman world, the total Mediterranean world, in 700 AD. It was not until 500 years later, 1200 AD, that a treatise is written by a Latin in North Africa explaining the cipher, the function of the cipher. Now, my own speculative going back into things of archaeology of the sea, which I've been so interested in, and the evolution of design of ships at various places due to the kind of woods they had and the kind of waters they had to fish, or whatever it might be. I'm not forgetting my Arabic numerals and so forth, but just as I mentioned earlier, an archaeology of the sea, where I was very fundamentally aware as a sailor that in they were building ships in the Sea of Arabia exactly as they described being built in the Bible. When human beings did go out in the water and were safely back, they began to like that particular ship very, very much. And you couldn't get those people building the ships and sailing them to change once they found a fairly successful one. So I found that the boats all around the world, they were quite different. You went around one cape into another. Fishing conditions were different. The seas were different. The different woods to work with. And so it was fascinating to me, the different types that were around the world, but they'd been holding steady for thousands of years. And I could see the interrelationship, and you could see which one came before the other. So I saw there really was a visible evolution, and archaeology and the sea was still operating over the thousands of years, and the land one is over long ago, and you're burying it. I'm uncovering it and trying to put some shards together, but this is something you could really get tremendous information. The fact that you could carry those cargoes enormous distances, and that people are still using ships in exactly the same way they had been. It's wonderful to go to India today and still see the numbers is extraordinary. Boats of yesterday have been running the monsoon seas for thousands. Those captains say they've been sailing in Africa and India for 10,000 years. That's their own reckoning. But the very little evolutionary change, and you learn exactly which ship could come before the other and why they kind of winds or whether the condition did what it did. So I've gained tremendously interest in being able to explain history from the water side in conversation, trying to piece it together archaeologically on the land side. Though there are relatively few people there, it had to make sense. It was an engineering kind of logic that would be much, much more revealing, I felt, than the kind of things that people could with their superstitions and so forth on the land, they could kid themselves into, even though this was exactly the way it was, it didn't necessarily have to be very logical. So I come back to the abacus. I'm quite confident I spoke to you about the probability of life really beginning on those South Sea Islands. And what I'm saying to you now is tending to prove to be correct. My theory of a half century ago is getting to be very, very highly substantiated. During World War I, beginning outside of World War I, the Germans controlled the Caroline Islands in the Pacific, and on one of the Caroline Islands, the most eastward of them, the German commander suddenly found himself being, the English ships had come in and taking him over. He wanted to get word quickly, because the World War I had not been announced. He wanted to get word to his commander, who was on an island 1,000 miles to the west. There was a legend on the islands that the people, the sailors with their outrigger canoes, very fast sailing proas, that they were able to go offshore, off the soundings. They could somehow or other able to navigate. And so he gave a message to the leading navigator's boatman there and asked him if he could get this message to his commander 1,000 miles to the west. the answer came back in a few weeks. He had done so. This is the first time the Europeans ever knew that the Pacific Island sailors did know how to sail off soundings and work on celestial navigation of some kind. There was an enormous European conceit that went along with the Magellans and the Drakes and so forth going around the world seeming to be so superior to their ships. And thinking about those people, naked people in the Pacific that don't know anything, just very ignorant people naked. Since World War II, when the United States had had a very large mandate to deal with in the Pacific, the Navy's had to do greater work, and it is now generally conceded by the students of maritime science that navigation clearly began in the South Seas, Pacific. There are various things that I can tell you about this that are to me very fascinating because I became a student of this subject. I take the large map of the world, and we can go. Let's look at my map over here. This Pacific, the Great Pacific Basin, all this enormous area in here, coming down to the South Seas are in here. And this enormous Pacific Basin, there's something very important. The language is all the same language for this enormous area. There are alliterations and dialects that come from it, but it's all one language. There is a professor who was at my Southern Illinois University in California, and then he went out to the East-West Institute in Hawaii, and he is a great expert on that language, and he also then put the problem into the computer. You can tell, if you're an expert in languages, what is an alliteration, what is the prominent way of saying this, and the ignorant way of saying it, how things change. Taking all the pronunciations on the Pacific and using vectors, it found that all the languages of the Pacific, which are all the same, all went back to the island of New Britain, just east of New Guinea, right here. Now, in the get into New Guinea, and you get over a mountain, and there's another valley, and there's people. Valley after valley, and there are hundreds and hundreds of tribes all speaking completely different languages, nothing to do with each other. Then you go to the land, and the difficulty to get from here to there, you get really, really separate languages, but these water people, all the same language. Due to the fact that you go incredible distances on the sea, in the history of the Maori, who had been to Hawaii, and the historic is known that they made several trips from your friend Jim Mitchin, who wrote a beautiful book of Hawaii. They made several trips, times they've been up in the Pacific and then gone back to New Zealand, where the headquarters are now. Those have been hundreds of years apart before they've gone back to, for the moment, some kind of headquarters. In the language of the water people of the Pacific, Maori, they were thought by the Europeans to be extraordinarily ignorant because they said they could only count up to two. They were using the binary system long, long ago. As we were getting in the computer world, we suddenly realized this is the way to carry on, so that you have to revise your appraisal of people on the basis of this, they couldn't do any better. Also, all these water people are considered to be very low order man because, in the first place, they didn't have any literature. Anybody, any culture would have a literature. Now, the fact is that if you live on the sea, you can't have any library out on a raft. The ocean's going to go over you, and that's not the way you're going to handle your information. in printed or on paper, so forth. The Maori have kept their history entirely by memory, and they teach the children their history. And when you come to the land places where the Maori will exist from time to time, they have these long houses and they have columns of the house and the ribs of the roof, which are the ribs, originally the ribs of the ship. And each of these columns is an ancestor. And they sing their chants about their ancestors. They're able to go back about 100 ancestors, and I doubt if you can go back 4 or 5. They rarely memorize, and they words and their chants say things they don't even know what they mean, but they, from father to son, they learn to say it that way. So if you do get any kind of key, you can really open it up. But it's been then carried on verbally, rather than being on printed paper and so forth. These water people then, being naked, don't have any pockets, and you're going to have to have some important information. I'm getting these what are called the long ears, where they split the ears, and ears can't open like that, and then here, these big discs, those have turned out to be actually cardinal points of the compass. This is a very extraordinary piece. Nothing can get off in that, and there's arms. So these various rings and things that they're wearing are ways in which you do calculations and things. These are the only pockets you have if you're naked on the sea. Not going to lose. Very important information. So things have been looked at as so strange to the European that so this is a wild, wild people. Are very, very mature, very economic, very efficient kind of information controlling devices. Now, one of the most interesting things you get into mathematics and the number, the language of science. Beautiful book by, I don't say his name quickly. It will come in a bit. In the number, the language of science, one of the classics, there is a listing of the names for numbers in different languages, all the different tongues of our earth. In the world of etymology, the world of the science of words, there are some words that are called old words that transcend any ability to trace where they came from, what they're all about. Amongst the old words, there are very few of them, all the names for the numbers are old words. They don't know where they came from, except for one word, for the name for five is very often identified with the root for the hand. But all the other numbers are absolutely, there's no physical experience that's any way connected with the word. They're apparently really abstractions, the words for abstractions. At any rate, if you see the names for all these numbers in different languages all around the world, Tobias Danzig is the author of Number of the Language of Science. If you look at his list then, these names, and I'm going to say to you, one of these two words means one and the other means two in these different languages. I want you to tell me which one means one, one, two. You'll never have any trouble. You suddenly find that there actually is a quite great similarity. And it goes running through them. The names for the numbers have very important similarities. And difference between une, one, the vowels, and two, a very vowelish one, and a very consonant one. And this holds true all through them. And so that one of the things you have to say, which is really very surprising, in view of something I gave you about this language covering the whole Pacific, and the names for the numbers all around the world having extraordinary interrelationship, either been some kind of angel that flew around the world dropping leaflets under names for numbers, or they somehow or other got around. The only way they could get around is by water, and the water would go everywhere. So it looks as though the water people have been getting around the world for a very, very long time before we have any record of it. And the more you know about the water, the more you realize the wealth that it really could command, you realize how secret it is kept. It is my own working assumption right now that man has been known about, it's what I call the great merry-go-round, where the waters and the airs go like that around here, take you into the Atlantic, into the Indian, into the Pacific. That this merry-go-round, where 90% of humanity out here in the ends of the propeller, this is unknown except for very few people. This gets you anywhere that you command the world. This is the command of the world, and people are not there to know about it. It was the key. It's the integration of the earth. And I told you, Adam on a hand startled the United States Navy by pointing out that the English discovered long ago there's only one ocean, and the center of that ocean is here. At that time, we hadn't gotten to the South Pole, though, knew very little about this. Captain Cook went around and he saw ice, but he didn't know the continent was there. That's the time when Y gets rediscovered. So, this is I want you to notice then, here's New Zealand. It's where the Maoris come to. I've gone to see quite a little of them, and I've been down there in New Zealand 3 times, and the head of an anthropologist who is in the University of Auckland is in Maori, and he is what they call the keeper of the chants. And I said, I wish he would. The tape recorders had just come, and they've never had tape recorders before. I thought it'd be a good idea if the chants were recorded, said how to be memorized where they are. And he said, no, they. That would be very much against their principle to have it done. They could only chant. You could only do the chants for other Maori, and they said you're not a Maori. And so I got up a little joke and so forth. And I said that I really was a Maori, but I hadn't been back home for a couple of 100,000 years. And in New Zealand, one of the very interesting things is an island way down here, you see, almost in the Antarctic. And there they have a very extraordinary mother of pearl. And the Maori have been taught to go down there, get that mother of pearl, and in all their houses where they had their ancestors, these wooden statues with their ancestors, the eyes of the ancestors must be this particular mother of pearl. So I explained to the Maori that the reason that these are the eyes of the ancestors down here was that the ancestors knew about the merry-go-round of the water. The Maori themselves hadn't really realized this, but by this time they'd lost track of that fact. But if you were here and you had a ship, if you could stay afloat on a raft and not, you could get around in all these places. And so I said, a couple hundred years ago, 1,000 years ago, I got stuck in the Atlantic for all these years, and I was just back. Somebody let me make tape recording, but he wouldn't let me do it. I'm introducing to you what I'm quite convinced about now, which is that life began out here on this water, and that it comes into the land. I give you about that and how we have the tribes going about the colors and so forth. The anthropologists and the archaeologists have been assuming life is somewhere here, somewhere kind of God needed them in here, and there's been was gradually somebody went west, east to India, to China, and so forth, and then from China down into India, they said. And all the assumption had been always that the arts and everything came from China south into Southeast Asia was very last. You go to your in. University of Pennsylvania here, the Museum of Science of the Museum of Pennsylvania has the task of doing archaeological work on the great diggings here in Northeast Thailand. In Northeast Thailand, we have place called Ban Chiang. If you look at your National Geographic magazines of Christmas time 3 years ago, the cover story is of this Ban Chiang discovery. There they have found a culture and many things in it, the quality of the culture, like discovering the Etruscans, an incredibly beautiful design. Here we have culture going back, what do we have, Egypt, 8,000, back 15,000 years. This is by far the earliest known. It's now completely conceded that this is where the Bronze Age began. This is where these water people came in here. In other words, I'm quite a bit more and more realization now of the theory that life really has come this way, rather than the working assumption of the Europeans that really, the land people, that they were so smart and so forth. I think in your day you'll learn more and more that this will be confirmed and confirmed and confirmed, whether it's the very old people you find on the east coast of Africa, because the traffic that's there, the kind of monsoon seas, you go right across that Indian Ocean back and forth, it's all involved in it. And I've been to South Africa and in South Africa and the Southeast Africa coast, I really feel very powerfully what I'm telling you about. The Mombasa, there was a professor and head of the architectural department at Cape Town, Thornton White, when I was invited to go there in 1958. He was an architect who had been trained and went to Oxford, and then he went to Harvard, a cultural man. And Thornton White told me that after just the end of World War II, the English were spending a great deal of money, as yet, guarding the east coast of Africa against smuggling. There are enormous smugglings going on in the Indian Ocean. The British had decided at the time of World War II, the British Empire was all over. I think historically, the people of England will get very great credit for, as far as I know, it's the first really top sovereignty that's ever really deliberately taken itself apart. They assumed that they really were through. I talked to some of the leading statesmen that were coming into World War II, and they said they this was going to happen. And they really deliberately pulled back and pulled back and pulled back. They've not really been pushed out. They did it absolutely voluntarily. So basically, this chapter of history is all over. Anyway, they were wondering whether to keep on looking out for the smuggling. So they had the Navy ships were used for to prevent the smuggling. And Thornton White, my architectural friend, had been born in the island of Mauritius, here in the Indian Ocean. There it is. And he had done a architectural town planning for the island of Mauritius. Because of his familiarity with this Indian Ocean area, he was made designated by the English government to look into the matter of whether it would be wise for the English to keep on trying to stop smuggling, to protect the businesses they had here, or not. And so he, in the monsoon seas, the ships that cross the Indian Ocean come down here, and in Mombasa they beach them out and clean their bottoms and so forth, get ready to go back this way. It's an annual thing, going with the winds. And the whole, so the big fleet of the Indian Ocean dows comes in there. So Thornton White went to there at the time when they were all be in highest concentration. When he got there, he said that he was taken to meet three or four of the top dow captains. And now one was seemed to be there, they seemed to have an admiral. He was the admiral of their fleet. Sergeant Wright, I must remember that he had been to Oxford and been to Harvard, and he had experienced what we call culture in a way. Sergeant Wright said to me that these Dow captains that he met, the leading ones, were the most cultured human beings he'd ever met anywhere around the world. And there's nothing compared to them. And he was astonished at their knowledge. They said to him, there was a curve in human affairs, these curves of acceleration, and get some finally to a peak. And then when there's a fall off, there's a shoulder form, there's really a very constant curve. Nature has shown you when something stops, it doesn't stop right away, and there's a fall off. They said, to their own satisfaction, they had actually been trading across the Indian Ocean, their forebears, that their law and their knowledge of the sea, one captain to another, that they've been doing this for 10,000 years. So they said, here's a curve of 10,000 years, and if the English could stop us, the deceleration curve will take 300 years. So we might as well tell them that. He said, incidentally, when he arrived there, they knew he was coming. They knew all about it on Granada, actually, and they put on an expedition for him, and they said, showed him. So he went back to all the English, might as well give it up. So they did give up that East Coast route. But this was in my greatest interest to me, that he thought he was deeply convinced that they had really good reason to believe that they'd been navigating for at least 10,000 years. And we get to find that there's an extraordinary culture 15,000 years ago would be right on that route. That's been very interesting. In my total subject that I'm dealing in here with you, I gave the name Naga quite a long time ago because there are the Nagas right here in India. In this area where people first came up on the land, Naga is a name, it means the sea serpent. And to the water people, if you look to the horizon at any time at sea, you see that back, the snake's back, the great sea serpent's back out there. And if you come up in a mountain and look down at where the sea comes into the land, it's obviously that way. We would call it a river, but it's quite clearly. When you can see the shape of the water, he was a serpent. And incidentally, in the art form of the Maoris is absolutely fascinating. They, to them, water is normal. An island is a hole in the ocean. They look on a harbor is the penis of the ocean going into that land. The sea is a positive, and the water is the land is a negative. I want you to really feel that the sea is normal. It's in this great motion. It's a very different kind of a tradition, and it's mighty. And yet it has extraordinary things. We find now that navigation they were doing, they were sailing the rising of this star, setting that star. I didn't mention these navigation tools that Tor Heyerdahl talks a lot about in his Easter Island, where they found these strange sticks crossing over. They thought some kind of decoration over there. All navigational tools. Now, all that's all thoroughly confirmed today. The Naga is then in Japan. The name for the river is Nagala, probably female Naga. There's a great deal that goes into what I'm, the kind of things I talked to you about of my Naga business. In Japan, the name of the, for the roof, the ceiling of the house is the word is the name for the bottom of the boat. I'm quite certain that the first people who began to get into contradiction to dugouts and outriggers and grass boats, getting into ribs, where the stiff ribs made possible really very large bellied boats. And those ribs then, the rib boat people, I was lucky to be in Cairo at a time when that sunboat was found about 20 years ago, and they let me in to see it. That same year I visited Norway and saw Oslo and saw the boat that they had found in deep in the mud, the Viking boat. The Viking boat and the Egyptian sun god boat were the same boats. They were plankings that had been lashed together. They had their ribs and they had the thwarts. The thwarting and the ribbing, everything, they were so absolutely the same boat, and I was astonished by it. I'm quite certain then that people learned to sail in the wind, as I gave you yesterday, the minute you can tack and you find that you can really work to windward, and people did work to the westward, in great contradistinction to the people who probably for other an untold thousands of years did drift on rafts. So it's pretty easy to design a raft, just take a number of the logs falling in the sea and tie them together. The people did get around in rafts, so they had to drift where the currents took them, where the wind took them. But the people began to develop the sailing boat, and the prevailing currents of the world are from west to east. So I think that this is what Thor Heyerdahl showed up in his Kon-Tiki, was the rafts follow those great currents of the Pacific. So I think that the early raft people who went from the South Seas, get up on the land, but also then go over to the Americas, both the west coast of North America and the west coast of South America. But now I have a water people who are starting westward instead of going eastward. A very different kind of a world. And with no wind blowing, you could row. And it's really interesting that and you can paddle. But the paddling dugouts were very poor. The very best of them you see in Thailand today, the king's great barges were several hundred paddling sailors on board. The Vikings had rowing. I think then people rowed to the westward. I think the Vikings are the water people completely out of this. This area, because on the Viking boat in Norway, there is a Naga head, an extraordinary kind of a sea serpent head, and it's very complexly designed, and its exact counterpart's been found in the island of Borneo. I think long before you could sail the windward, then you row to the windward. So the prevailing winds coming from the west, so the road boats got there a little earlier. And we get then the Viking boats coming, getting to cold country, and they're suddenly going to have to, as a winter, they want to winter out. And you take your boats out and you put them upside down, and you can live on them. You immediately have a land shelter, because they're designed for enormous sea, so they can stand the rains, no trouble at all, in the snow. Then I see them taking these boats and putting them, not only one, but bringing them together as a cross form, adds in. And we have then, this is a church form, we've got to call the nave of the boat, the nave. This is an upside-down boat. Absolutely confident, all the rib buildings, and the rib roofs that came entirely out, turning boats upside down originally. Because you were not getting that kind of engineering, except by virtue of the sea. Now, these things get to be quite exciting as I go on. I found then the water people did everything in the terms of the verbal carrying on. So we find the Norse, what they have, the saga. we know the Japanese are absolutely certain that they came from the South Sea somewhere. And their tales, and also you find this in Bali, the same word, raga. These are the tales of the old people, the chants. Whether it's the naga, the raga, the sagas, these are all the how to keep your history by word of mouth. I'm just giving you a little bit of my feelings about the naga story, but I'll tell you one part of it that I find excites the great many of the scientists. We have the Garden of Eden story. And this is in the Garden of Eden, somewhere in Mesopotamia, Babylonian area, somewhere in there. And what I think went on all the time, because this has been able to be well established in the South Sea even today, the chieftain of an island, a chieftain is a strong man, as I gave you, the big guy. And every once in a while, his people begin to not think he's very good, and he needs to establish his credit. The chieftain has always been able to go to the navigator. The navigators on those islands live absolutely separately from other people. They may teach their son, but they may teach somebody else's son, but they have an absolute tradition, and the chieftain sees they're kept absolutely separate from the people. So the chieftain says to the navigator, "I need a miracle." The chieftain doesn't know anything about this boat, so the navigator knows how to then go and into his swift sailing proa and going offshore. He knows how to get to an island when nobody's been to before, and he knows that on that island they have one of these things and so forth that nobody's ever familiar at home. So all he has to do is bring back something to his island, give it to the chieftain. The chieftain holds this thing up, and everybody realizes he's an absolute miracle man again. He's been ordained by some great mystical power. So the navigator is always able to get the chieftain some way of reestablishing himself, so that there's no question. We know all through that world, all the navigators are always kept separate. Those navigators then, finally, when they're crossing the Indian Ocean to west, landing Mesopotamia and Eastern Africa, they began to go up on the land. They began to be both priests and astronomers, and they, using their astronomical things, did a great deal of the pyramiding, so forth, to keep track of these astronomical data. And they were able then to tell the pharaoh, the top man, what to do. And time again, but they kept the secrets themselves. This is all going to bring me back then, trying to do mathematics and the Arabic numerals and so forth. You've been quite a little while on this session, but I'm going to wind it up with the following. You remember your Garden of Eden story very well, I'm sure. And now, for now, the priests, when people began to catch on to something, promoted some kind of story. And the better the story, the more easily they then were able to hide the secret. They had then this Garden of Eden story. This is when the human beings had then started going to westward instead of going with us. In the Orient, earlier, going with the rafts, we went off in a raft to say goodbye to people and never saw anybody again. So there was really a continual dying while still alive. Don't you understand this? And you went, God blew you this way, and the time went with it. You were always going along with God. But when you started sailing to windward, you seemed to be defying God. So these people who went to the Western then have to have really a new rationalization of their going to against God's wind. So they really have then a God who lets them in on some information, all right, that you're going to get into trouble if you use it. This Garden of Eden story. I'm going to come back to this. We have Adam, take a rib out of Adam and produce an Eve. That's not a very, very credible story. That's a way to produce a man. It's like a rib from a man. The man was there, and the woman came out of him. Anyway, the people that did go to sea and learned gradually that the best of sea creatures are whales. The seals although had ribs. So the rib cage became very, very impressive to that sailor. And he finally then tried it out in his own boat, which had been, at that time, reeds that all folded up and did not have any stiffness. So as far as I'm concerned, the rib of the Eve part has also been absolutely fundamental through the ages. The ship is always a female. This place, the ship has an insideness, sort of a womb and so forth. You don't understand why, but she's female. Ships have always been female. So I'm confident that Eve was a ship. And she was made possible by the ribs, the rib cage. And the ship took Eve, Naga, the sea, the serpent. Naga, the serpent, showed her the ship that you could go around the world. The world is a sphere. That's all the apple is. This is a, you know, find that the great priest had the pharaohs pronounced, well, they would have the orb, and they have the two serpents going around the two ways, go either way and get there. This is very fundamental to the sailor. I was asked to be at the opening ceremony of the Maritime Museum in Haifa a few years ago, and I was asked to speak at it, and they've been doing an enormous amount of discovery of things, because this is the greatest museum of the Phoenicians, and they've been getting so much diving, so well, great have been brought up. And one of the most prominent of the coins is a sailor's coin. Is the Janus is a god of the sailor, but it's two-faced. And everybody said this because sailors, you know, are very unreliable people. But it isn't so. This is because the sailor knew you can go either direction, come back right up, go this way or that way, you can always come back where you were. You'll find this very deep in the symbolism of the navigator sailor priest. So, what I've just given you of the Garden of Eden story, that Eve was a ship, and she's made possible by the rib. Adam's experience, that he had a rib cage, and so she, the ship, had the rib, and Naga, the serpent, took around and showed her the earth was an apple, was a sphere. And so then on the king always had an orb to hold, and he didn't know why the priest had him hold an orb. That's enough for this time. We'll stop for a while. You've been very, very patient. The word Naga is a very basic word. The Na of Naga is the Na of Navi, Navy, Na of Native. It is a nativity. Na, and we have navigate, naviga, naga, and the V is the way of the sea. It's a very, very, very powerful, fundamental kind of a root. Area from Japan to Burma. This area is Burma back here. Japan to Burma. These people use something very extraordinary, the three-way weaving. This ball is from that middle of that area. And this is, you can see the triangle, what they call the three-way weaving. They make their baskets three-way. All around the rest of the world, is all the baskets and all weaving is two-way. It's 90 degrees. Pretty interesting that these water people are use a three-way. And so their fish baskets, they even an enormous thing, they put an old animal in it, terribly strong, made out of bamboo and three-way weaving. The two-way is very unstable, the three-way completely stabilizes. You see how it catches up to itself here. I gave you the two triangles the other day. This one, you see this triangle here and the triangle here. And you go just as far as you can to get to the center of the triangle, you can't go any further. And this one here goes to the center of this triangle. So this is a limit of possible travel between the centers of the triangles. Now, that three-way weave area is also then, as far as I'm concerned, the water people, the world people, and I'm quite confident we're going to learn more and more about this. In the same South African, Southeast African experience that I had, down in the South Africa we have the color reds, people we don't really know where they come from. I learned in South Africa something that really fascinated me. I don't know whether you were it was in Egypt, we have Queen Hatshepsut. She was really one of the great rulers of Egypt. And she, it's recorded that she sent her people to the land of Pun to get the pitches and things for her ships. The land of Pun is the, where this, this area in here, Somaliland and so forth, that's the land of Pun. I learned from the, and Rogers talks about this land of Pun, and the Egyptians. Anyway, I learned from the South Africans that the word Pun means, is the word red, R-E-D, the color red. And this land of Pun, we get then to the Red Sea and so forth. It's a Pun Sea. The Pun is a very interesting word because it also then relates to something somebody spoke to me about here, the pundit. It is the thinker. The person who'll be able to calculate, and we have the Pun are the Phoenicians. The Phoenicians, later on the Phoenicians, the Phoenicians were these red people. It seems like the color red might be that. The Phoenician, later on Phoenician, the Phoenician, Phoenician, seem to be the same water people. I think the Venetian. The Punic Wars, the wars of the Phoenicians and the North Africa, Latin Wars. So the Pun, that's also you get in the Pun of a boat, the we call a punt. So the Pun is both boat and it is the wisdom. And it is really was a key to me about the concept of the Phoenicians and so forth. Red. Now, and not to, I'm in such a speculative world with you here that. I'm going to cut pretty quickly here, but I'd like to go a little more into the tracery of the mathematics which comes out of the Indian Ocean, out of the abacus, the ability to calculate, again, sliding rings, very much as these water people have rings on their arms, and they slide rings on beads on bamboo rods. The navigators coming up on the east coast of Africa and coming into Mesopotamia, the Babylon, and we have the very interesting interconnection now of the island of Crete and Mycenae on the land, the water people, and the Mycenaeans and the Cretans apparently very closely interrelated. We've established a complete relationship now between Babylon and Crete. Crete was very particularly of importance in that Aegean world and the Eastern Mediterranean world, and it was completely unfortified because these are the water people who were now really absolutely controlling the waters, therefore they didn't need any fortification. Nobody could get their island. And I've become particularly interested in Crete. I've been there quite a number of times. And in the great palace of Gnosis, which then the Cretan civilization breaking down in about 1400, the palace of Gnosis, in the king's quarters, there is the king's symbol. The archaeologists call it the double axe. It is simply the hexagon, strictly the hexagon. And if you draw the hexagon with two sides like this, one of the two opposite, and they call these double axe. I don't know why. But anyway, clearly it is the hexagon with the six radii and the six chords. And then the woman's side of the household side, they have the distaff. And this distaff sign, you find them in the walls a great deal. And the distaff side is a square with a cross. It's like the English flag with the two crosses, the diagonal cross and the perpendicular cross. And that's the distaff side. So there's this 60-degree angle in the king's side, and there is the 45-90 in the distaff side. In history, I find it a fascinating matter that going back to the history of science and history of scientific technical artifacts, we have irrigation in India, so forth, and there is absolutely suddenly out of a complete void historically of science. We suddenly have quadratic equations in Ionian Greek. And this seems to me to be a very abrupt matter. And everybody tends to think of those Greek geometers and the Greeks as the beginnings of mathematics. But the beginnings are really a very high level, the quadratic equation. Llewellyn Thompson is the anthropologist at the archaeologist at the Institute of Advanced Study in Princeton. He's also head of the archaeological American teams in Athens, and he restored the stone, and I got to know him. And I said the following to him, as you go into synergetic geometry with me, you're going to get more and more into that triangle which I've already introduced you to, in the tetrahedron, and the fundamentality of the triangle. And here was this hexagon in the king's side, and the king, this is a world of navigators, where the king is the king because they rule the seas, the water people. And we find that their mathematics and advantage was tied up completely with Babylon coming from the Indian Ocean. So I became fascinated with the idea that because the navigator had been able to keep their secrets so completely up to this time, that the falling of the great palace of Gnosis occurs when the really master water ocean people are broken into by the lesser water people of the Aegean, and they are suddenly, their mathematical tricks are taken over, and the Ionian Greeks represent then for the first time mathematics coming out into the public domain. has not been there for a very long time. And this explains then this very suddenness of its appearing in the history. It had been kept absolute secret up to that time. Thompson thought this was a very reasonable working assumption. But what fascinated me most was that the king had kept, he was working in the 60 degreeness, and he had the people working in the 90 degreeness. I've already made you clear to you really this difference between the squaring and this inefficiency and the enormous efficiency of using the drawing, but apparently this seems to be, and I go back then into a Solomon's seal or whatever it may be, but get into the triangles of the seal of highest wisdom and so forth. That the triangle is known back there, but it's known to leading very powerful people, but it's not out in the public domain the way to calculate. Now, I'm not being deliberately slow, I'm changing my subject. I really opened up today and historically talking about this Greek period and the Mycenaeans going to Troy and the siege of Troy, and I spoke about then the grand strategy of land peoples for a very long time, while man didn't know much about boats. Land strategy, just the big and heavy and high, the fortress, the city-state being a very successful form of invention. For the people, powerful people, able to keep themselves very powerful with it. Having all the things inside the walls and people outside starving. Troy seems to me, and Homer, to be then the beginnings of a realization that the water begins to bring a line of supply and you can then have besieged these great castles. I point out to you then that in Italy, the time early Venice. Nothing could be more impressive than Venice because Venice, all the rest of Italy, great castella walls. And Venice, absolutely no walls whatsoever. And these were then the great water people. And the water people were gradually taking over on the land people. And so that Venice didn't need any fortification because it controlled the seas. We find then the rest of Italy very, very hostile to Venice because they were able then to break the great security of Castello, moving the ships around and bringing in. Now we have, up to this time of Venice, and the more I can see of history, the Orient then is the beginning, and the Southeast Orient is the very earliest beginning, and the knowledge that is required and the culture is very, very great, and nothing is more extraordinarily impressive than the ancient Chinese history of what humanity really had learned, where we have quaternary alloys of metals, deliberately quaternary alloys of metals, back in 400 BC. And so now we know that metals game began in the Southeast Asia, going back thousands of years. So that there was, in the game of the people who were able to sail to the windward, they would come back to the Lord, and they were able to go back home and get great riches, and found that the people opening up the frontiers were very strong people, but had great needs, and they were able then to continually cash in to the westward. So the European world opening up and around the Mediterranean brought about then a market for goods from the Orient. And there were four main routes from the Orient. You could come north, the Lake Baikal, the Sea of Azov, and Caspian, the Black Sea, and in through the Bosphorus, and what is today the old Alexandria, or whatever it is. But the point was you were coming into the north of the Aegean. And this was the Orient, and from there on you get on waterborne and get to various ports and goods could get up, gradually up into Europe, opening up of Europe, of Northern Europe. Then there was another route coming over Sin Kiang and the Khyber Pass through Persia and to the either across Mesopotamia to the Asia Minor coast there, or it could come down into the Sea of Arabia. Then there was the traffic coming via the Indian Ocean and by caravanning over Arabia to the Mediterranean, and a fourth great route of coming from across the Indian Ocean to East Africa and then getting onto the Nile and coming north into the Mediterranean. There are four main routes, and these four main routes of bringing great riches to Europe were of extraordinary importance to the masters of the earth, whoever they might be, the great masters of wealth, particularly the water people, but the great traders and people who made the most out of integrating wealth of remote people, then the great battling over these basic roots. I see something that goes on then in that eastern end of the Mediterranean area where today we're having all the Israeli Arab problems and so forth. I've been on the committee of the mayor of Jerusalem on an international committee which he formed to advise them on Jerusalem, to try to keep the multi-world viewpoint operative in Jerusalem. And in studying of Jerusalem and its history, it's extraordinary the numbers of times it has changed hands, and what it's apparently is that there's what I spoke to you about, the Sea of Azov, and there's a northerly route, there's a predominantly southerly. There are four routes, but I can break them into two northerlies and two southerlies. The Olin, the Sea of Azov one is really the Marco Polo kind of route. The other three come pretty south because they get into Persia, and they tend to get to the Arabian Gulf, or they can't come overland. But there's enormous competition between who's going to control the taking from the Orient and cashing in Europe. And I see then that the halfway between the north and the south routes would be Jerusalem. Jerusalem then is when the north became very powerful, and the people from the north came in, and just the maximum outpost they would reach. And the southern people came in, and they would take it. So we have the Egypt trying to take over. We have to finally get where the northern is, like the Crusaders coming down and fighting the south and the south. In that extraordinary battle of the Mediterranean, we find the last great chapter of it is the chapter of Venice, which had taken over from the Phoenicians, the Venetians, and the Crete, and so forth. And suddenly, the mathematics I've spoken about become so improved with Arabic numerals that we have the king of Portugal. And suddenly, with mathematical capability, you've calculated a great deal about building ships. You calculate very much better for navigation. So Henry the Navigator opens up an entirely new world, building really big rib ships, much bigger, more powerful, and going from Europe right around Africa all the way to India and the Orient, China. But very much better than the interrupted routes that you had coming through the Near East, where you had overland and water, many transfer points, but you go all the way from Europe all the way to the Orient. And this came about due to the enormously improved technology that developed also with mathematical capability. So that from the time of the Leonardos on, you don't say there were no more Leonardos, because the great masters of the great land areas who were able to build ships then really took their Leonardos to sea with them. And they became really the great designing admirals of the fleets, and designing extraordinary ships and more technology in the sea. And so what happened starting with Troy is that the line of supply took over on the fortification. And as of getting very much later to World War I was a question of the line of supply. And we've gotten to the point where these great navies of the Atlantic, where Spanish ran it, called the Spanish Main for a long time. All this enormous gold they're taking out of South America and the Central America. And then suddenly that is broken. But we have first the Portuguese and then the Spain. It goes to keep working north, more northerly people getting apparently a little greater strength. And we have what we call the British Isles. And All this picture goes on in this piece here, where they've taken from here with a 52% demand, its longest old history, developing enormous riches, and taking its wisdom and its riches The British Isles then became the unsinkable flagships, commanding the most harbors and the most customers. And those islands are just fought over by water people, so the Irish coast is hardly a foot long. It hasn't had bloody battles. The Irish coast, the Scottish coast, everybody said, who can control those islands? So the Angles and Jutes were long ago displaced, and very powerful people kept pouring in there to see who's going to control it. And they said, whoever controlled that then controlled the great sea traffic between the Orient and Europe. But from now on, everything is line of supply. I said then, we have the Navy battles and counter-distinctions of land. I was a regular United States Naval officer at the time of World War I, and it was said that when the high seas fleet comes out, the two high seas fleet come, there would be, you have what you call contact. And with contact, they said, you'll know within the first or the second salvo who's going to run the world for the next 25 years. If you compare your hardware. And it really was a matter of engineering design by now. You had to have good skills at seamanship, sure. But the big thing was, did you have a gun that could out, who could carry the greatest hitting power, the greatest distance, the shortest time, the greatest accuracy, least effort? And so, nothing was more really secret on these ships than with two ships of the same tonnage. They looked the same. They designed about the same experience humanity's had by now over the seas. They make a little bigger type. So all kinds of different types of ships are different purposes, whether it's a destroyer or it's tonnage. And you don't know till contact who with the same tonnage can outdo more with the same tonnage as the other man. It's the most highly classified of all the information of the navies. And of the air, whatever it is. And what goes on in the puppetry warfare between Russia and the United States is trying to keep sounding out the other guy to see what he's going to do with his tonnage. The scale always gets tipped by both sides. Can keep up apparently about the same, but suddenly contact who does more with the same or more with less. Now, that brings it up to a very modest stretch. At any rate, I spoke about Navy then is contact. It's all over very quickly. So we have World War II, the Blitzkrieg was simply the sea warfare coming up for contact on the land. So the ship of the sky and the tank was simply a submarine coming on the land with wheels on it. And very, really a mobile fortress. We have the Maginot Line was the end, historically, of the bigger and heavier and higher the walls, the more secure. Suddenly, Blitzkrieg just went right over it and didn't count anymore. This is really historically much more important than people can realize, because it has to do then with fundamental sort of mobility and what comes out of the sea and the engineering. I've given all kinds of recount. We're looking at the people doing the right things for the wrong reasons. And doing things out of working misassumptions of economics, but mainly I want to review then what the technology it was and the big transition that begins with the fall of Troy ends with Maginot Line of the static of just the ability just might does the trick. From now on, it really is capability improved, doing more with less, and so go very rapidly into the sky now, where one little airplane suddenly sinks a whole battle cruiser, as General Mitchell saw it can do way back just after World War I. And so I'm now trying to confront you with patterns of very big significance, where there are very great changes, and to get feeling about them doing more with less of the sea. Because when I came into the Navy then, with the kind of history that I do have that I've reviewed with you, where suddenly things were happening very rapidly, all the impossible things were happening. I was then trained as United States Naval officer was in the following terms, which suddenly had the telegraph back in the beginning of the 19th century. But Abraham Lincoln was the first head of state to be wired by telegraph to each of the battlefronts. Up to this time, the head of state, the head man, had to be present at the critical battle to make the critical decisions. But suddenly, he could be in a central position. And this is a very new game. But there were no wires from Washington, say, the city of Washington, Abraham Lincoln, to the Navy. Suddenly, World War I, we did have the radio. And we soon the enemy could decipher and decode you, and therefore we didn't send message by radio that would call of a highly strategic nature. They could only, those messages had to go by courier, and a courier couldn't go any faster than a ship could go. Historically then, once you put somebody in command of the Navy, and really the Navy was a risk of the most powerful people in the landowners began to really go to sea with their ships. They got into a new kind of a game of the world. And they were interested in the commerce, and they had a lot of people then doing the farming. They're not doing that farming anymore themselves. That's out. The big attention then, and the power that said we're going to go to war was in the sea, and the masters of the water ocean world then had in the Navy, they were, whoever was command of a Navy, you had all the power of that nation. In fact, there's no such thing as a second-hand Navy, so you had the capability to run the world within that Navy, so when the Navy went to sea, you had to have somebody on board there. The people who were in the highest authority had to have somebody on board they could trust, very capable, that really understood the world, would think world. So the training of the naval officer was a very different kind of training to the training of the land. And so you would put in every type of ship. You were put into Navy Yard, so you get to be an industrialist. You were put in the jurisprudence here, so you understand those matters at sea. You were put into statecraft as a naval attaché. But the assignments were very short. 6 months, 9 months, a year, to get you on to the next year. They had to get you absolutely comprehensivist. Found it absolutely exciting that as Harvard and the land university were going in for specialization, the Navy went exactly the opposite direction. They picked out the very brightest of every class, and first they sent in the Bureau of Ships, which is the theory of ships itself, and they did everything to make the naval officer a comprehensivist. Now, there was a power structure that had to be the comprehensivist, and the people had to be divided. So I ran into a completely different world when I got in the Navy. I was astonished by it. Now, then, as an officer of the line in the United States Navy, you were being trained so that if your senior were killed, you could take over. Therefore, you had to be able to take over and be skipper of the ship. And I did. I was skipper of several ships in the Navy. If your admiral went over, then you had to take over the fleet. The naval officer was being trained in this way to be comprehensive, to be absolutely capable of taking over. And the promotion of the naval officers, in contradistinction to the army was done by the number. And just a matter of succeeding by the number. But the Navy was entirely by selection after lieutenant commander to get where there's a gold on your cap. This was entirely by selection so that whoever the big powers of the world, if they like this young man, they're really going to come. They can move him right up to being admiral of the fleet overnight. It was then a very different kind of service, and the kind of information I came into was fascinating because at the time of World War I, the world had been run up to that time by the British Empire. The United States had no ambitions to be a world people at all, and the United States got drawn in on trying to save democracy. So both sides, Germans and English, tried to bring in because the question of who was going to run their interest, who was going to run the water ocean world. And the British Navy then, the Germans said, these people are guarding the surface of the sea. And they went underwater and they went above the water. Got an entirely new geometry. And they began to sink ship after ship. The line of supply was what counted. And the the war had been joined in Europe, in France. If it ever got over onto that British Isle, that's what they're after. You're moving out towards that's the command of the world. And so if it got over the mainland, they were all through. The point where then the masters of the water ocean world found their ships were all getting sunk, and they were unable really to get the shore going. And they were about to lose when actually in two things happened. One, they got the United States come in, the productivity was enormous. And in the Navy, I then got in the service as aide for secret information to the admiral who was in command of the cruiser and transport force when we took a million people across the ocean with 130 ships. And this is a very fascinating kind of a matter to have that kind of training. Now, at the time that I came in the Navy as a young naval officer, at this point the British said, we have to have all of the ships in the United States producing enormous numbers of ships being sunk. And for the first time in history, the British said, we allow the American Navy to come to parity with the English Navy. And I was amongst the young naval officers being trained at the time when the masters of the world ocean world were having to tell the young officers in the American Navy how you run the world. And I said, I've never been in on this before, but suddenly I was in a very extraordinary moment when I was really being brought into world grand strategy. One reason I think I'm able to talk this way is this kind of comprehensive training. So what began to fascinate me very much was the idea that the Navy, you could float in incredible weights. Therefore, anything that the man ever found out scientifically, technically about the world, he had it on board, and he could do incredible things. Now, I said to myself, how did it happen then? I've been doing all this training, I know how to run my ship, I really know what's going on around the world here, and why do we have this contact, and why do we have to take all the highest capability man to this moment of kill? And then this brought me into great, great intimacy with Thomas Malthus, and I don't know whether you... how much you know about Thomas Malthus, but I also point out to you that as of what's been called the British Empire and known as that for a very long while, to me is a misnomer. If you get into Drake and Queen Elizabeth backing Drake as an incredible pirate and very daring pirate, and he was able then to, he really ruined the Spanish, and the English were able to take over the Queen Elizabeth. But it was a game of pirates against pirates, and what became what's called the English Empire was really the people who were risking enormous wealth. Queen Elizabeth the First was secretly backing Drake to do all this, and she kept telling the Spanish she wasn't. At any rate, the people who did the risking, going to sea, went after great riches, and that's really all that counts. The East India Company then was the name of the great risking organization of Queen Elizabeth, and we find then the East India Company is these are world people. They're water people. They're world people. And their job is at sea. You know, the western end of their Orient to Europe run was the British Isles. And the British Isles then, place where you're going to have to refit your ship or you rebuild a new ship. This was then where you did a lot of mounting your capability to be at sea. And the English Isles happened to have beautiful wood and all kinds of mines, and they had earlier had tin, and the Caesar had come there for that tin, and that's how the Romans built roads all the way from Italy to through Europe to get to England for tin. And these British Isles then were very rich, and not only they commanded all these harbors of the customers, but it was a great terminal place to rebuild your ship. And because the ships were either built anew or rebuilt there, they also had to have the crews. And I was visiting a professor at the University of Bristol a few years ago, and when I was there, you can still go down and see the down by the waterfront. There's a where Robert Louis Stevens wrote his Treasure Island and many of his other stories, of the great pirates. But down there there's a brothel there, been there for hundreds and hundreds of years, where they hit the men over the head and they came out of the brothel and threw them on board the ships. As they did not enlist. This was not the British Empire. This was not the British people. but Britons got thrown on board the ships, and as these ships appeared all around the world, they had Britons on board, so there could be no British Empire. But it was really never an ambition of the British people to run the world. It was entirely a matter of the great East India Company. Now, the East India Company had a college for the training of all of its officers and all of its servants. There's East India Company College is still there. It's a very beautiful campus you can go to in England. And in 1800, the professor of political economics of the East India Company was then Sir Thomas Malthus. Thomas Malthus. Now, Thomas Malthus, I want you to realize that he also said this time, the sun never sets on the British Empire. It is a very extraordinary kind of empire, because all the empires that you and I read about historically, it's Genghis Khan, or even Alexander the Great, everything's around here. It's a little postage stamp area of total Earth. What was called civilization in those days was about 15% of the surface of Earth. Really very small. But these are the great empires, and as far as anybody could see, the maps went to know, you know where the maps go to out here. So they're just flat, they were flat empires. They were open, I call it postage stamp, they went out to infinity. And out beyond them, you came to wild people, and you better not go any further. So the dragons. And the British Empire, unlike that, comes after Magellan has gone around and Drake has gone around. It's now in the public domain. We have a sphere. And Thomas Malthus is the first economist in the history of man to get all the economic data from all around a closed system spherical Earth. It's absolutely different from a flat plane that goes to infinity. And Thomas Malthus being the first to get all the data from around a closed world, when he did get his data, he published a book, and then 10 years later, his second book, when he had much more data. These are all the vital statistics, because the mass of the water ocean world, they had in a different place around the world there, the ambassador might be the king's brother, really was a hostage, and they got up quite a game finally of finding the gold was being stolen, the sea, the Spanish gold being stolen. So instead of having gold in their ships to go trading, they then had their king's brother as a hostage in the court of China, whatever it might be, and said, annually we go over the books and find out how much this country owes the other. That's where the balance of trade came again, to get the gold off the sea. And then we'll just move the gold from the Bank of England vault, the Chinese vault, to the English vault, or vice versa. So that they were able to get the gold off the sea and avoid the hijacking. But the point was, Thomas Malthus was the first political economist to receive the vital economic statistics from all around the world. And he's able then to say in his second book, 1810, he confirmed his first, quite clearly, man is reproducing himself at a geometrical rate and producing the goods that support himself only at an arithmetical rate. Therefore, quite clearly, man is designed to be a trader. Now, up to this time, you had an infinite world. You might not like what's going on, but it was kind of an infinite world. Then you had an infinite number of gods, you had an infinite number of hopes that might come true. But Thomas Malthus said, that's all there is. There isn't any more. It's a closed system, and there's obviously no way another going. It's a very different new way of looking at it. Okay, we find then the great master of the water ocean world had a great scientific servant telling man is quite clearly designed to be a failure. The same masters of the water ocean world then began to take the scientists, found the scientists had microscopes, could see things that the master of the water ocean in the world couldn't see. The scientists, you got a very different kind of eyes, and by this time they'd found steam, and they said, scientists could see all kinds of things. Therefore, they began to have ships going around the world with biologists and geologists, amongst them Darwin, with other biologists, to to find, discover resources which could be exploited around the world that would not be recognized by the man with the naked eye, the old sailor. So Darwin, amongst the biologists, being taken around a closed system world. Now this is all the all the other biologists, this is all the species that are, quite clearly there's interrelatedness with the vertebrates and so forth, developed then a theory of how the design evolution occurred within it. And I spoke to you about the wild horse the other day, method of the insemination by the most powerful stallion. So Darwin then explained as survival only the fittest. Darwin said he did not mean any economic, later on he was very annoyed when people said he made economic inference, but the great master of water ocean will say quite clearly, nowhere near enough to go around, man's supposed to be a failure, and survival only the fittest. We obviously the fittest, we're sitting right here on top of the heap. And we're the best informed, we've got the best ships, and we have everything well organized. So we really understand great powers really taking things over and why they felt what they did. In England, contemporary with this, is we have Karl Marx finding the doubt of Malthus, finding the doubt of Darwin, which comes 35, 40 years later. He said he agreed with both. Survival of the fittest, and not nowhere nearly enough to go around. But Marx said quite clearly, the worker is the fittest because he knows how to handle the tools, he knows how to handle the stone and the wood, and he's handle the seed. He's intimate with nature. These other people are parasites. We have then the basic, absolutely, it's the beginning of power statecraft around the world. Now it's a scientific fact there's not enough to go around, and it's survival only the fittest. And that really starts then the two great poles of the so-called free enterprise and the purest of socialism. Both of them, it has to be you or me. Now there's something I'd like to add to things I did put before you yesterday about no race. We have at the time of all right through history, it's just clear to me that that power, the big man, the king, and the nobles, who is often his bastards, seem to be brighter, and the common people seem to be very dull. It was a sad fact they seem to be dull. And what was really going on was that the king, and this goes right on up to the 19th century. But the king and his nobles owned all the animals. They did all the hunting. And the animals lived on all the different kinds of herbs and so forth. They had a very good chemical background. So that the nobles were living on the meat. And they were the fighting people. They said, we need all that meat, and you other people don't do that fighting. So you got to live on the roots. And the roots are very different kind of roots in different places, and often very limited kind of chemistry. It was just potatoes or whatever it might be. We find them only in the last, but as clear as can be, the court assumed, and everybody assumed, the poor people and the nobles alike, that there are really two classes of people, that the nobles and the king were something absolutely different blood, therefore the king and the nobles must intermarried to keep that strain going, that they are the strong people, and these other people are very dull. Now this is working assumption, where also Karl Marx assumed that it is a worker, but he's pretty dull, and therefore he's going to have to have he's not enough to run, so he's going to have great austerity anyway. He's got to do things a very simple way, really goes along with pretty dull people, but he assumed a class, that there were two classes of people. That the working class with some other strain of blood, then you'd have to kill off this other breed who are the parasites. And these are two different blood groups. It's really brought about this phenomenon you call class. I assure you, when I was young, by this time things are getting better for humanity, and I can't tell you how I resented the concepts of class. It just seemed to me absolutely awful, but the class phenomenon was very powerful, I assure you. The Crowley trait. And everybody assumed it was so. But the thing that bothered me always was that my friends who were poor tended to be pretty dumb. It really bothered me terribly because I've been told there's really two classes of people. Now, come to, for the last 15 years, and only 15 years, we have had incontrovertible scientific proof that undernourishment in the womb in the first year of life, and you're liable to have damaged brains. This is nothing more powerful. And when I say undernourishment, it doesn't mean that you don't have enough potatoes. It means the wrong, not the, the right spread of the chemistry. So that undernourishment, when people do not find, then the nobles got that the meat, which had the enormous variety of foods that all the animals were eating, so that they were not getting this damage, and the poor people were. I'm absolutely convinced today now that, because also it's good nourishment come along, standard living has gone up during my life. I've been just amazed at all the people who used to, that I knew of that kind of circumstances they come from, were dull and no longer dull. They're just bright as can be. Of course, I'm absolutely convinced that neither race nor class, absolutely not. This is a very deep and powerful my feeling about that. And this is not old enough kind of a fact to be in the political great arguments. But I think it's going to have a whole lot to do. I go on with you further about what I think we have the way options of human beings, what you as a little individual, each one of us as a little individual can do. But when you have those options, it's going to have a lot to do with it, to really be sure to have out in the open. We're really dealing with a world people, a recrossbreeding world people that got tremendously isolated, differentiated out for various reasons, and all coming back together again. It's like the maps suddenly bring things together. So, there I was, Navy, and I'm deeply convinced of the information now about Thomas Malthus, and I understand then why I was trained in the Navy that is now at parity with the masters of the world. Therefore, I was being trained to be one of those masters. And I said, you know, in our Navy World War I, we had refrigeration. And that's the first thing actually hit me. I don't know why, but we had on board ship, but I knew I couldn't get it on the shore. We could have cream, and it refrigerated 6 months to find cream or whatever it was. And the Army's having canned milk. As we developed this sailing ship, which is going to the steamship, first thing you had to have in a steamship, you had to have water for your boilers. So the first thing that happened with this steamship was they had to develop then desalinization. You could not have steamships without desalinization. So that's something that's been thoroughly done and very effectively for a very, very long time. I hear very little get done for society about desalinization because they say it costs too much. And when you find any arguments about whether we should be actually making our own fresh water versus they always go back to what costs for the water to come down from the mountains here and through our aqueducts and so forth, and costs a few cents more per 1,000 gallons. It's literally a cent more too. We're saying we're not crediting what it costs nature to get that water uphill there and to start coming down and so forth. How long it took nature to build all the total watershed that we have there. We call that for nothing. But when we're calculating about making something, then they do take them, charge the interest and then the debt on the money and so forth, capital kind of cost. So I find that this is really a lot of nonsense. But anyway, always say when suddenly the summer when New York doesn't have any water, then what's it going to cost you? This kind of penny pitching thing is so absolutely absurd. It goes on time and again. But also, I can understand how it happens. As you go along with me, I want you to always keep in mind all the evolution of man and here the evolution of his information and the grand strategies he has employed and the momentums they can really build up and the condition of reflexes. Now, what really was important then is we had this steamship. We found that you could ride the ship so hard through the sea that it decided to go in the sea of steamship. She could really be, then you could stand much more impact with the seas and last better. You're going to have then your boiler way down below the waterline. You've got to have an enormous amount of oxygen to get in there, so the first air conditioning develops at sea to get that water down there. And you couldn't have, there's no daylight way down, there's no portholes down 20, 30 feet below the water level, so that you had to have, we had enormous power, so you had auxiliaries there. That's where all the great first electrical generators went. This is where, this is the market that produced electrical generators. So that we got all those ships then had electrical power, electric light, long before people on the land were having it, years before we began to have it. And the, we had to set the desalinization for 20 to 25, we had refrigeration 20 years before anybody had up in the lab. Here I was then in the Navy with all these firsts that had the air conditioning and the desalinization and refrigeration and so forth. And I said, Thomas Malthus didn't know we were going to have refrigeration. He's a wooden ship man, and he assumed the foods would rot over here and could never reach the mouths over there. So I said, what else did he leave out? And he didn't know we were going to take the tin from the Strait settlements and throw it very thinly onto steel, thin steel sea, make tin cans very, very cheaply, and the food could be preserved. He assumed foods would not reach the people. I now know they can. So I said, what else did Malthus leave out? Then there was suddenly that radio which I was being involved with, and the, I said, here, one, I was telling somebody while you were out, I was in a Navy project in my transport service. When the war was over, World War I was over, President Woodrow Wilson decided he must go to France and meet their side with all the people to decide what to do as we pull out of the war. President Wilson was the first president, really, he'd be enormously hooked up electronically, so he needed to have very good communication. So on board of the steamship George Washington, we installed some new radio apparatus, and I'm talking because this is the Bell system, that a Bell scientist during World War I had developed the concept of getting voice on the radio, which is so poor that we had it in our battleships, and you could actually wig-wag where you could see further than you could talk, anyway. But and he, this Bell man had invented a way of going from spark to arc set with telephoning. So we put in completely new apparatus on board the George Washington, and on President Wilson's second trip back to France, we spoke from Best Harbor to Arlington. It's the first transoceanic voice, and I was involved in that operation. So I felt very strongly the radio. And the voice was it. We used to get a message across the Atlantic, you had to send a ship and have a man. That's the only way you get it there. And so I said, now just a couple hundred pounds of apparatus, and I can get there 186,000 miles a second. The more I begin to look at things here, it looks at me, and suddenly we've got this little airplane. This airplane's going to sink a battlecruiser. Quite clearly, we're doing more with less. In a very, very big way. And it could be we might do so much with so little that we might be really able to take care of everybody. Because the whole Malthusian thing is the basis of all economists. The economists don't want to look into technology. And there's not a phrase, a sentence, a word in any book in economics about doing more with less. It's always, you do it with the well-known. So I began to realize there was something really potentially coming up, and because I was on a big enough pattern of understanding the grand strategy and understanding that this was what it was all about, I could see back in 1917 there was a possibility sometime we might get around to then doing more with us. It seemed to be acceleration going in that direction. So I did come out of the Navy, went in the building world, and in that building world I got 240 buildings between 1922 and 1927. When I decided to make my little peel off, I committed myself in principle to precession, or that you'd get on all right if you committed yourself to doing what nature's trying to do, trying to make man success instead of trying to earn a living. It's a very big break off that I made there, but I did it with enormous conviction. If I really attended to how you do more with less, what I saw that nobody understood at all was you might have very much less for housing. Everything was these great big stone, enormous things. The steel building is just coming in when I'm a young man, just coming in, and they're just insinuating steel inside of a stone building, and the stone building a little bigger. There still is a stone building out there, pretty much. So I saw that there was incredible ignorance operative in the building world. It was still out of the fortress idea, more with us. I said, isn't it lovely, little airplane, and little woman of all this thick, and it's 45 degrees below zero out there, and very comfortable inside here. And I'm going through the air many times at the speed of a hurricane, and these houses won't take hurricanes. I said, I think it's very, very possible to really use advanced technology only going into war and the weaponry for the housing. Then it could be that this is, see, there's something called priority. In all the great emergencies, you have the high priorities. The priority is who's going to get the high performance materials, the high performance capabilities, the high performance tools. There's not enough of them. So what task you put there? So you have the first things first that have to be done. So when you have priorities, like every action has a reaction, if you have priorities, that have to be the anti-priorities. What doesn't get the priorities? And if what doesn't get the priorities, it's always been the home front. Anything to keep the rain off while you make the munitions and send the boys to the front will do. And that was psychology. So I saw that nobody ever looked at their buildings, and they keep staying in that fortress kind of a phenomenon. So this then, well, I'm really going to look. We said there's nowhere near enough to go around. Therefore, you never spend the capital in the direction of trying to make people a success. We now know it's impossible. That'd be absolutely down the drain. Therefore, we really only do it in the direction of the war, and hope this byproduct salaries and little profit would work out fairly well for humanity. That's the best you can do. So, as I said, this was what brought me then around to the individual homes, to the geodesic, the Dymaxion house, and later on, geodesic domes and so forth. That brought me into then structuring, and you can understand what I feel about getting into defense integrity, how much you can do with how little. Because I really now know that it's highly feasible. I can to close environment because tensegrity, you remember, tension has no limit length. It's very different from compressional structures, you have very limited length. So all our buildings are on a compression basis. And all the engineering's that way, and they will not credit tension. Yet I found what makes my geodesic dome stand up is the tension. Therefore I found that I can go to I can make any span you want. To go right around the earth, we have a complete sphere we want to go around the earth, a 10-degree sphere. If there's enough material on earth, we can make another environment control for the whole earth as far as that goes. But the point, in pure principle, so I saw that I could get in very large, beautiful environment controls, and I can really tell you now that I now know the technology, I know the exactly the ways in environment controlling to take care of snow loads, hurricane loads. Incidentally, these structures are incredible as far as earthquakes go. They're just like bell buoys. Nothing happens at all. They're ships. They are finite. They come back to themselves. And the buildings we built are open up the squares. Everything just crack apart. It's just nothing happens. The earthquake maybe tips over like that, so it's like any bellboy, any boat. So that I know that it's possible to give you 300 buildings for one, for given hurricane, earthquake, loading, any of the things that buildings have to do. I can give you 300 buildings for one, give us the best known engineering strategy other than 10 segregated spherical structures. Spheroidal, they can be. Caterpillars and so forth. They don't have to be a pure symmetry. But the point is that I know I can give you 300 at once. And when I do get in that, then I now know that is not only compounding what I gave you about the energy studies we did here, I now know it's highly feasible to take care of all of humanity. The area has never really been looked into. Nobody's looking into it because they said, no use in looking into the building, the living room. So it's not a matter then of the customs of yesterday. So it's really a matter, if man is going to survive, we're really going to have to use the kind of technology we see really coming up. And if we do get somewhere now, we get any kind of disarmament, then what's been a high priority capability of the whole air space technology becomes released for the home front. Now, Again, man not understanding what's going on and also being very much against himself, we come then to the space programs. And what has really gone on there could not be more valuable to humanity, because as you know, you and I are born on this planet, and there is a biosphere, and there's all this oxygen debris. I mean, great. One of the realizations of great army commanders, so forth, was that you caught a massacre, you usually find some water, and you find some food over there. So all they concentrate things on the weaponry and how to teach the people to fire the gun. And this man could be taught within a week or so how to fire that gun. So, but as far as you didn't have to do anything about the man, because he could sleep on the ground, he's going to get some water, there's some water around there, and food. You got him in a uniform, so he'd be easier to control him this way, and getting into obeying orders. But you didn't have to do about it physically. It was not until World War I, when we did send 1 million people across the ocean, and that there had never been a transport operation like that in history. And the expense was very high. And they discovered that it was cheaper to repair a man in Europe than to send a replacement, if you could. This is what brought money behind medicine for the first time in history. That's why there's been an extraordinary change in the whole of the survival of man is up. So suddenly humanity got the idea of having hospitalization, really getting medicine for everybody. It could be a little man's game. Now, I need a little help. I made a digression in my medicine.
Space program.
That's right. So, on the sea, there still was air to be breathed. And there was desalinization, that the water was being taken care of. The man could just sleep in the hammock. You didn't have to really do much about the man. But when you came then to the space program, for the first time, you're going where there's no air to be breathed. There's nothing that a human being really needs. So in order to take a man out of our biosphere, you have to find out for the first time, what do human beings really need? What do you need for human beings keeping going? Nobody ever really got down to that. They say armies went on the belly and you could take the next man's farm. You didn't know. When you ask human beings how much you really need, how much land to produce, how much food to keep you alive, you know that each human being needs an acre, you need 10 acres, what do you need? I find absolute ignorance about this. Of course, they're varying conditions, but in magnitude, nobody really knows. The space program is the first time we really had to find out. And the idea then of keeping people in space for protracted periods of time, as against just a, what I call a sandwich and thermos bottle trip, to really keep them there, then you really have to learn all about human beings. And you find that they are a process. Now, both Russia and the United States have had some extraordinary programs going on, research, and in them for quite a few years now, we've had groups of human beings living inside a controlled environment. There are windows so they can, people can look in at them, inside and so forth. There's telephones, you can talk out all right. But they've literally been put into a controlled environment with a certain amount of equipment, a certain amount of supply, to see how this equipment really works. But they began to find watercress got into a very important part of a recycling way of getting pure waters and so forth. Some very extraordinary discoveries we made. But anyway, we're at a point now where we have had, I think it is six men inside this controlled chamber for a year, where we really do have them going, where the amount of apparatus necessary to take in there, equipment. In addition, the original supply you take on, because they recirculate their waters, if the deposit gets recirculating the water, and then get the first purification is perfectly good for washing and cleaning, and the second purification is absolutely pure for drinking. If they've been able then to get down to where, for as a six man, the apparatus that does everything goes into one large airplane suitcase. And the total weight is 250 pounds. So divide by six, a little over 45 pounds, I guess. A man carries a back 70 pounds in an army pack. This is a relatively light load. 45 pounds of apparatus per person. And that apparatus is going to, some totally, when the Russia and the United States get through paying the kind of bills for that, will run into whatever it is, maybe $10 billion, something gets spent on it. But when it's all done, it still is aluminum and iron and so forth, and you, per pound, the automobiles around have gotten worse and worse. But I remember when they were 25 cents a pound, now they've got 50 and so forth. But the airplane running somewhere in the $2 to $10 a pound, they're saying 45 pounds for you and $10 a pound, which is much too high. Still talking about $450, and here you've got the equipment to take care of all your needs. It may not be familiar to you, you're not used to it, but the point is you're actually recirculating the inputs you have to and add there annually is very small. Probably won't be 450 when it gets through, but what we've done, developing the equipment plus the environment controlling, and I know I've really got my own environment control, and I've brought in the advanced structured research of that NASA, and I'm very confident about our structure side. We have now where you ought to, if it's worth $450, I would be able to rent it then for, say, I'd be able to rent it for maybe $30 a year. Still get paid off pretty quickly. You're going to get down to $2-3 a month is all you need for all the equipment to keep your life going. Now, all I'm saying is that when we found out how to keep man alive in space, out of the biosphere, for the first time we found out how to take care of him anywhere in the universe. This is the first really important research on what the human beings need, we ever known. Never went into that because they're all excess and they're mostly created. We never looked into that. We've looked into repairing them medically, but we never said, what do you need to make them a success? Only in that space program we've ever done that. So I hear lots of people say, never mind the space program, let's house everybody. And I said, do you know what you need for a house? What's a house? If you get into the Italian kind of houses, we're giving everybody here in America and so forth, you won't take care of 30% of humanity. The material's not there. So let's stop the nonsense about, let's say this is wasting money. Luckily, it really has been the most informative program we've ever had. So you say, well, the kids won't like that. People are not used to living that way. Just noticing that when people, the astronauts, do get doing it, everybody's watching them, and all the kids are watching. And with the satellite relay and so forth, by the time we really have people living in space for 2 and 3 years, everybody be looking at it all the time, and nobody would ever be so well known, and the way the things work for them, they're going to be everybody's concern. By the time we get that program really working, so you have life being well taken care of anywhere in the universe outside the biosphere, then it's going to be, and the kids will say, that's critical to when you get on here. That's the way a kid is. You're not going to get into complicating himself with going to Bellevue, Stratford anymore. So, I want to have a little feeling for you of man in his fear. He was always able politically to get enormous appropriation when the enemy is coming, and that's what the enemy is going to have, going to destroy us, so we've got to make the big effort. There was the only time when we really had a great mandate. And so man in his fear, looking out for the people, I said, not really looking out for himself, but looking out for the people who depended on him. That's what it was always the game. We then have inadvertently done some very good things for the wrong reasons. But fortunately, that's all part of this evolution. We got a new level, completely new level, and the space run, to me, is run by far the most important one that I know we've come to. We've gone well over our time, I'm sorry. The see if there are any more final connections. I use the Naga because I want you to get going into the grand strategies and the intercourse and really feeling those great caravanings and voyagings and why the masters who really do make money, why they were doing the kind of tricks they were doing. Because from now on, as I go on with you, we're going to have to get in our own grand strategy. What are the things that really need to be done by man? And as I signed off tonight, just along with the idea that space program is bad and so forth, let's realize that with the United States, Russia, China, NATO, $200 billion a year for war, somewhere around $30 billion, amongst them, goes into psychological warfare, where they say instead of waiting for the war to come, it's much better for us to break down your other man's economy so he can't even make war. And that's exactly what really did happen in the 60s. Got to the point where to young America again never really felt it's for the world. It just will not look out for just itself. And there was then a breaking down of the confidence in the idea that all the great corporations ought to have great war contracts, all those things which used to look, everybody thought it was great. Suddenly found the only place where the flag was on a factory, and this thing began to look very wrong. We really are at a point where a great psychological warfare did go on, and I'm sorry to say it goes in for narcotics and does anything ever to break down the other man's economy. But one of the games it does played an enormous psychological one where suddenly we find an enormous propaganda against, say, the supersonic American plane, but there was none against the Russian. The Russian was very, very successful, but this was not carrying on. Again, that was part of that who's going to do most or the least game. So that there are many things like space program is bad, so all the technology is bad. There are also, you can understand how society falls for it. That's easy to see. But the point is, very much of the pushing of a lot of things that I've said has come out of the psychological warfare. I'm not for any side. I'm absolutely apolitical, and I'm absolutely sure if we stay political, we're licked, so that I'm not giving you any political position saying what I'm saying here at all. I do want to recognize that many of the things that we find are being said, society sort of talks very glibly about, like technology is something new by man, I feel very much of a propaganda invention. That we'll stop on that for now.